Good. All right. Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the March 13th, 2026 Santa Ana Water Board meeting. We don't quite have enough board members present just yet to be able to take action, but we do have enough people here, both here and online, to there's Leticia.
Thanks, you too.
She snuck in on me. Okay. All righty. So, welcome to our meeting. We are meeting in person and via Zoom, and this meeting is being webcasted and recorded. For those who have completed the virtual speaker card for this Zoom meeting, you'll be on mute and your camera will be turned off until it's your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking, you will be placed on mute and your camera will be turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting or exit the meeting. And for people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is also available. So I'd like to ask our board members to introduce themselves, and we'll begin with Board Member Lopez.
Yes, good morning. My name is Al Lopez. I am the former mayor and councilman, City of Corona, and also a longtime board member of Western Municipal Water District in Riverside County.
Board Member Clark.
Good morning, everyone. Letitia Clark. I've been on the board since 2020, and I'm a former mayor of the city of Tustin. Nice to be with you.
Joining us remotely is Board Member Chris Murray.
Good morning, everyone. Chris Murray, pleasure to join all of you today. Been on the board since 2018 and former mayor pro tem and councilwoman for the city of Anaheim.
Okay, and also remote, Board Member Rue.
Yes, good morning, everybody. I'm Bill Rue. I am a council member in the city of Montclair, California, and I have been on the board since, I think, 2001 or two. And I had planned to be in person, but I have an appointment later today that I need to handle. So it's easier for me to be on Zoom today. Thank you.
And to my right is Vice Chair Alvarado.
Good morning, everyone. Gloria Alvarado. I'm a resident of the city of Santa Ana, and I would like to welcome you all. Thank you.
Okay. And finally, I'm John Scandura, the Chair of the Regional Water Quality Control Board. I live in Huntington Beach, California, but I was born and raised in the Inland Empire. I also note that we are broadcasting from the Mary Nichols Building, the auditorium in the Mary Nichols Air Resources Board building. So thank you to the Air Resources Board for providing these facilities. And I note that way back when I first started out with the Department of Toxic Substances Control, my first meeting as a project manager, the attorney representing the responsible party was none other than Mary Nichols. She had just left the first Brown administration. So a phenomenal person. So it's an honor to be here. So we do have a quorum. A majority of the board is here with us in person. Board Member Murray and Board Member Rue are participating remotely. A little bit about the ground rules. The Open Meeting Act requires board members who are participating remotely to disclose whether there are individuals 18 or older present in the same room. If so, state the general nature of their relations with those individuals. Board
No.
Member Murray, Board Member Rue.
No, I'm
I
in
have
a
no.
private office with the door closed.
Okay. No for both of them. The Open Meeting Act also requires board members remain on camera for the entire open portion of the meeting that is publicly accessible via the internet. If a board member needs to turn off their camera during the open portion of the meeting, they must announce their reason for doing so that council can advise whether an exception to the on-camera rule applies. So we now move on to our second item, which is our public forum. We always welcome hearing from the public. Any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker request for those items listed on today's agenda. You will make your comments at the time it is being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum, and comments will be limited to 3 minutes. Jessica, do we have any speaker cards for the public forum?
No, there are no speaker cards.
Thank you. We now move on to item number three, and do we have our State Board Vice Chair Doreen D'Adamo? Is she available?
I am here. Good morning, Chair Scandura, members of the board. Good to see you all remotely, however. I'm going to start off with groundwater recharge. So on February 19th, last month, just before the storms began drenching parts of California, and I know we're all experiencing some higher temperatures, but it wasn't so long ago that we had a deluge in parts of the state. Our staff, under delegated authority, issued the last of 9 groundwater recharge permits for the wet season, bringing the total amount of water authorized to 43,000 acre feet, or enough to supply 128,000 households for 1 year. These 5-year permits are really helpful because they allow for recharging aquifers for 5 wet seasons without having to come in and obtain an annual permit. This is an important strategy that a lot of areas are using because to actually obtain a water right is quite extensive and involves going through CEQA and quite a bit of process. And so this is a way to sort of dip your toe in, no pun intended, but to get started on the process, see how it goes, and take advantage also of some of the reduced fees that we have for that program. And while I was waiting for the meeting to start, I was just going through the morning clips and do see mentioned here from the governor's office, the press office, about a new report that just came out, is released today, that highlights California's vital work to recharge groundwater basins. And it's a detailed report about what's going on here in the state to have groundwater recharge be part of the state's water supply strategy to address the reduction in supplies that we expect to see with climate change, and also just to more sustainably manage our groundwater basins. And so I'll just quote here, it's a governor's quote: "California's long been a leader on water policy, and we're taking an all-in approach to securing our water future, including recharging and expanding groundwater storage. We're preparing for what's ahead, but we also recognize that there's more work to do." He really says it best. And so really excited about the work that we've done in this area and what more we can also do. Moving on to wildfire and resiliency, want to give an update on that program. Our staff continues to collaborate closely with the California Natural Resources Agency to implement the March 1st, 2025 State of Emergency Proclamation to fast track critical fuel reductions projects. Our staff has reviewed and facilitated approval of over 100 projects, a major milestone highlighted at the California Wildfire and Forest Resiliency Task Force meeting last fall. Eligible projects are encouraged to use the application that's available on the Wildfire and Forest Resiliency Task Force webpage. I don't have notes before me on this, but it just brings to mind that we are in process of working on our utility general order, which facilitates in vegetation removal projects that the utilities are working on. And just really want to thank Executive Officer Lindbergh and your staff for providing meaningful input for us as we move forward collaboratively with regional boards to finalize the adoption of that. I don't I hadn't come prepared to talk about it, but stay tuned for further updates on adoption. We hope to finalize that soon. On February, our administrative hearings office released an amended hearing notice for the Delta Conveyance Project hearings. The petitioner's rebuttal portion of the public hearing continued on March 2nd, and the protestant's rebuttal portion will begin in June. And those hearings are ongoing. Look at the pro look search for the program webpage if you're interested in following those hearings. At our March 3rd board meeting, our board discussed for the second time our annual priorities. And what we're looking to do is make some changes. We have a strategic work plan that we release every year. And what we've decided to do is there's just some key programmatic areas that even though maybe they're not, there's not an item coming up for this year, we really want to highlight some of the key programmatic areas. For example, the Safe and Affordable Fund for Equity and Resiliency, the Safer Drinking Water Program. And so we're looking to make some adjustments there and have had some really good discussions and expect that the next discussion will be at our April meeting. Also on March 3rd, we talked about our priorities for drinking water regulations and heard from the Division of Drinking Water regarding their recommendations on prioritization of drinking water regulation development for the calendar year 2026. This was a really this is a tough call because there are so many pressing needs and a number of contaminants that we're looking at moving forward on either updated MCLs or new MCLs, you know, for PFAS and that sort of thing. And so really trying to be strategic, use our resources wisely so that we can provide the greatest protection for the public. And so what we did talk about is the need to have further stakeholder input. We did receive public comments, but there's an interest in doing a bit of a deeper dive on this. And so I believe that we'll be scheduling some workshops on prioritization for drinking water regulations soon. Just a quick update on SAFER. They had their SAFER advisory group held a meeting yesterday on March 12th. Those meetings are open to the public and encourage those of you who are interested in further tracking our SAFER drinking water program for equity and resilience through those meetings. On March 5th and 6th, staff held a series of fee stakeholder meetings. These are the annual meetings that we have. We have three of them to discuss for the regulated community and other interested parties. One meeting on water quality, one on water rights, and one on the environmental lab accreditation program. Moving on to vapor intrusion workshops. Cal EPA's Vapor Intrusion Work Group is hosting five virtual public workshops to share and gain input on Cal EPA's efforts to address vapor intrusion at contaminated sites. Workshops being conducted this year between February and June. And the most recent workshop was this week on the 10th, the focus of which was vapor intrusion holistic approaches, conceptual site model, and best practices. Expert panel, our staff did hold a public working group session for the second statewide agricultural expert panel this week on March 11th. The session was to facilitate panel deliberations on issues relevant to the charge questions. We've had several of these additional meetings scheduled. The panel is, you know, they've really rolled up their sleeves and are deliberating in a very public and transparent way. I've joined in on some of those sessions, and I'm really looking forward to getting the expert panel report as they suggest. Methods going forward for our irrigated lands regulatory program. Our board will be receiving the report, and when we receive the report, we'll have an opportunity for the public to comment on the report. U.S.-Mexico border funding. Our board is accepting public comments on the draft emergency regulations and guidelines to administer Proposition 4's U.S.-Mexico border funding. Written comments are actually due today at noon. Our staff conducted two workshops going through the guidelines, emergency regs, and application requirements and scoring criteria. Held a workshop in San Diego on March 5th and Calexico on March 6th. And we will be considering adoption of the draft guidelines and eregs to administer the appropriation of these funds on April 21st. And then last, I want to mention that the Statewide Advisory Committee on Cooling Water Intake Structures will be on March 20th They'll be meeting, and this committee advises our board annually on implementation of the water quality control policy on the use of ocean and estuarine waters for power plant cooling, also known as the once-through cooling policy. So it's really important that we get a report from an independent agency on the condition of the state's power supply as this policy gets further implemented. And during the meeting, this committee, also called SACWIS, will be considering and approving the draft SACWIS report, which summarizes the state's current electrical grid reliability needs. The Los Angeles Department of Water and Power is expected to present on their progress toward attaining the once-through cooling policy semi-annual milestones and final compliance. And that's all I have, and am happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, well, that's quite a bit. Thank you very much, Vice Chair. And I'd like to ask our board members if they have any questions or comments, beginning with those of us who are here in the room. Board Member Lopez.
Yes, I have a note here that I was doing some research on the waters of the United States, and from what I hear, from what I see here, is that it was published on November. What's the update on that particular issue?
Yes, so there's been a lot of activity on this through the years. And under this administration, a proposed rule came out. And because I don't have the specifics before me, but there's the rule came out and there was an opportunity for public comment. Our board did submit comments and obtained information from the regional boards because this really affects you all in the implementation. And the effect of this, not concerned about whether or not we will be able to protect waters because we have strong authorities under Porter Cologne, and our board did anticipate this years ago and adopted dredge and fill procedures. And so there's a lot that we had, a lot of actions that we have taken to be prepared for this, including obtaining some additional funding for positions, both at the state board and the regional boards. The comments are under review at this time, and I don't have a sense of the anticipated date where we will learn what the final rule is, but I can report on that the next time I appear before you.
Any others?
Thank you for your question.
For our board members online, Board Member Rue.
Yes, a very quick question. What, after reading quite a bit in the news and hearing quite a bit, what is our status with Colorado River Compact?
So the Colorado River is undergoing, an ongoing. We've had a little bit of a drought relief here in California, but not so with the Colorado River. And there are seven basin states that share in the Colorado River, and they have been under direction from the United States Bureau of Reclamation and that runs that project, and the Department of Interior. There have been several attempts to obtain a consensus, and it's my understanding, although I don't have any inside information other than what's been publicly available on that, that the seven basin states have been encouraged to come together and figure out a way to share in the reduction. I don't have the figures before me, but it's quite
That's
high
okay.
in terms of millions of acre feet of reduction that is expected to see on that basin. We have, as part of our periodic hydrologic update, we do have, I expect that we will be receiving an update soon from the Colorado basins, states. And next time I appear before you, I'll include that on my list as well. They're under a directive to take action within a certain amount of time. And if they don't, then the basin states have been told by the Department of Interior to expect that there will be requirements that they will all have to participate in the reduction. It's really important for us, obviously, as part of our imported water supply, especially, in Southern California, and water security. But this is a complicated issue. We do have California has some of the strongest water rights on the Colorado, and with expectations, to make adjustments. There've been, the last round several years ago, many years ago, transfers that occurred in the Imperial area and transfers over to San Diego. And that, of course, triggered some additional impacts on the Salton Sea. So I know that there's, a whole team of people in California that are being thoughtful in how to proceed on this, but no agreement at this time.
Thank you.
Board Member Murray.
No questions at this time, but thank you as always for it being so thorough. Great to see you remotely.
Thank you.
And then as for me, I have a couple comments and questions. I note about the groundwater recharge report that was submitted, highlighting how California is at the forefront in that effort. And certainly at the forefront of the forefront is our region. We have major groundwater recharge projects going on here in the Santa Ana region, including North Orange County by the Orange County Water District, and then in several locations here in the Inland Empire by our major water districts out here. So we're very proud to be part of that effort. And then I also want to thank our staff, beginning with our executive officer, for their work on providing input on the utility general order. And this is for vegetation removal to help reduce the risk of wildfire. So that's a very important effort, and thank you very much for that. And then I just one more question for you. I remember about 2 or 3 years ago at one of our meetings, we had just had a very rainy season, and we had a heavy snowpack in the Sierras, and we were all pretty excited about the fact that we would be in pretty good shape for water. And then all of a sudden we had a very hot spell. It caused much of that snow to evaporate or go into the ground. And so the runoff wound up being minimal this year. Is there a chance that we're going to have something like that this year? Because the weather's been really hot.
Yes, that's a good question. I think all eyes are on that, and definitely the most recent reports that have come out, and I don't have it committed to memory, but that intense snowpack that we got, we ended up, seeing it, as you say, evaporating. And then the question becomes, evaporating, into the atmosphere, or, turning into runoff. And the situation that we had several years ago, it was just really unfortunate because of the pattern in which we receive the precipitation. So with the ground, coming into that wet season, initially that wet season, after drought, the soils were parched, and I believe that the first event that came in, this was, I think, I'm not remembering 2022 or 2023, but the first precipitation event that came in as snow. And it's better when that first event comes in is in the form of rainfall, in order to saturate the soils, to prepare it for the runoff. And that didn't occur a few years ago. I don't believe that that's the situation this year, because I believe the first round that we had, it was, a bit warmer. And so I can include that on my list. Your questions are all really good. And this is, of course, front of mind for everybody as we experience this changing climate and having to make adjustments.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Vice Chair Diadamo. And we'll now move on to our next item, which is approval of the meeting minutes for the February 6th, 2026 meeting. Do I have a motion? Moved by the Vice Chair. Second.
Second.
And seconded by Board Member Alvarado. I'd like to ask Jessica for a roll call vote.
Bortnander Lopez.
Aye.
Bortnander Clark.
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado.
Aye.
Bortnander Nuri.
Aye.
Bortnander Rue.
I need to abstain as I was not at that meeting.
Harris Gandora.
Aye.
Motion passes. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Next item is the consideration of the consent calendar listed as item number 6. At this time, I want to ask if there are any interested persons or board members who request to move our single consent item.
I'll make
Seeing
that
none.
motion. Bill Rue, I'll make that motion.
Seeing none, board members, any questions or comments? None, seeing none. So, Jessica, are there any speaker cards for this item?
No, there are no speaker cards.
Okay. So, I now request a motion and a second for our consent calendar item.
I think there was a motion.
And do I have a second?
Second.
Second. Okay. Been moved and seconded. Jessica, if we could have a roll call vote.
Lortnander Lopez?
Aye.
Lortnander Clark?
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado?
Aye.
Lortnander Nuri?
Aye.
Lortnander Rue?
I saw an aye there. He was muted.
Aye.
There we go.
Chair Scandora?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Okay. Next item is waste discharge requirements for the remediation of the GE Flatiron facility. Flatiron Groundwater Treatment Facility at 501 West Francis Street in Ontario. I ask our board staff, Alan Koch and Mona Baruz, to give their presentation.
The first slide, please. Good morning, Chair Scandura and members of the board. My name is Alan Kwok. I serve as the manager of the Groundwater Protection Branch. My co-presenter is Mona Baruz, supervisor of the site cleanup section, and George Paredes is the case manager for this site. Together, we will be presenting about one of the most complex and challenging sites we manage. This is a legacy site with abundance of technical, regulatory, and environmental justice challenges. We are sharing this information today to support your review and consideration of the tentative waste discharge requirement, WDR, order for groundwater cleanup. To keep the focus on the decision, we have divided the presentation into two parts. First, we will give a high-level overview of the site's history and briefly cover soil investigations, cleanup actions, and vapor intrusion evaluations. After that, we will move to the second part, where we will discuss groundwater issues and the proposed order for the board to consider. This site, outlined by the pink rectangle on the map, covers 10 acres in the city of Ontario. It is located about 2 miles north of the 60 freeway near Euclid Avenue and about 1.25 miles west of Ontario International Airport. The site is located in a severely disadvantaged community, ranking in the top 10% for pollution burden under CalEnviroScreen 4.0. Addressing contamination here is an important part of reducing environmental inequities. Historically, the site was used for clothing iron manufacturing for more than 60 years, from the 1920s to the 1980s. The facility also manufactured equipment for World War II. Operations included degreasing and chrome plating, which led to extensive soil and groundwater contamination. The primary contaminants of concern are volatile organic compounds, VOCs, such as tetrachloroethene, PCE, and trichloroethene, TCE, and metals, particularly hexavalent chromium. These contaminants pose serious health and environmental risks. The site is severely contaminated, and the cleanup is a long, complex effort that will extend many decades and centuries. Regulatory oversight began in the 1980s and continues today. Much work remains, and the long-term cleanup and management will be required for many generations to come. This long timeline may be surprising, but it reflects the reality of the site's complexity, the widespread contamination, and the limits of current cleanup technologies. The extended cleanup duration is not a matter of choice. Here is a historical photograph from the 1960s. The former facility is smaller than what is outlined in blue. The site is basically the large buildings within the outline. Let's start with the conceptual site model. Think of this as a 3D cake slice of the site. To reorient you, north is to the right and south is to the left. Above ground at the surface is the cake frosting. The subject site is basically the two buildings shown on the surface. Historical operations included degreasing and plating operations. A degreaser and a VOC storage tank are shown in pink. A chromic acid tank and cooling tower is shown in light blue, and product storage is shown in light gray. Now let's move below the surface to the cream portion of the cake. In this layer, you can see the discharge of contamination into the ground, the pink polygons for VOCs, and the green polygons for chromium. Soil contamination can create problems not only in the soil itself, but in the groundwater and even the air. The blue shapes and the brown arrows show how contamination has moved into clean soil, affected groundwater, and released vapors that can rise into buildings. When these vapors enter indoor air and create potential health risks, we call this vapor intrusion. Once contamination gets into the soil, it becomes hidden underground, making it very difficult to see how far contamination has spread. Contamination doesn't just move straight down. It follows paths of least resistance and can spread wider as it goes deeper, similar to what is shown here by the pink and green polygons. For sites where groundwater is shallow, say 20 feet below the ground, these challenges are easier to manage, and full cleanup can sometimes be achieved within 30 years. However, when the soil column is much thicker and groundwater is deeper, everything becomes more complicated and the cleanup takes longer. At this site, the soil column is more than 350 feet deep, which makes investigation and cleanup extremely difficult. Sites like this can take several decades to centuries to fully clean up because of the severity of the contamination and the limits of today's cleanup technologies. Many technologies that we frequently use at less complicated sites are not viable at a site like this. For example, at sites with thin soil columns, you could simply dig out that contamination with an excavator. However, it is not practical to do that 350 plus feet down. This site is extremely challenging. Investigations are difficult, remediation is difficult, and that makes remediation expensive and prolonged. We would love to clean up the entire site with the snap of a finger. However, the reality is that it is not quite feasible or practical. That doesn't mean we simply accept the damages associated with this contamination. We take an adaptive approach to cleanup. You have contamination that poses urgent risk, and you have contamination that poses low risk. These are managed very differently. Urgent risk require immediate actions to protect public health and the environment. I will focus on two urgent risks during this presentation: vapor intrusion and drinking water impacts. Vapor intrusion threats continue to be addressed through soil remediation efforts, vapor intrusion mitigation systems, and continual monitoring. Threats to drinking water continue to be managed through the groundwater pump and treat operations. Lower risk contamination can be addressed through long-term sustainable solutions because they are not immediate threats to any receptors. We will not see full cleanup within our lifetimes, but we will ensure that the adverse risk associated with this contamination, particularly the impacts to human health and drinking water, are promptly and effectively eliminated. Finally, let's talk about groundwater, the cake sponge. We will go into more detail in part two of this presentation, but here is a quick overview of how it fits into this model. Decades of discharges have caused extensive groundwater contamination. The VOC plume shown in pink and the chromium plume shown in green move with the groundwater flow, which generally flows south, some from right to left on this figure. The groundwater plume is 2.25 miles long and half a mile wide. This is a massive plume that has impacted drinking water wells in the area and threatens to impact more. We understand the size and shape of the groundwater plume by sampling water from monitoring wells, a few of which are shown here. I also want to highlight the two extraction wells, EW1 and EW2. Those extraction wells are part of the site's groundwater pump and treat system. Their purpose is to help stop or slow the groundwater plume from moving farther away towards nearby drinking water resources. This site is very challenging to investigate and even harder to clean up. So far, almost $100 million has been spent on addressing the contamination. Completing the cleanup will take a long time and require significant additional costs. Our site cleanup relies on the discharger's reporting when contamination is released into the ground. That is usually how we identify new sites and begin working with the dischargers on cleanup. This is the ideal scenario because it allows us to respond quickly and limit how far contamination spreads. However, when dischargers do not report releases, we sometimes discover contamination in a much worse way, through indirect signs such as finding contaminants in drinking water wells. This is clearly not ideal. In the past, this happened more often because the risk of these chemicals were not fully understood before modern environmental regulations existed and before industry practices improved. Today, stronger regulations now make these situations less common, but they can still occur and require immediate action when they do. This is a legacy site from a time when regulations were weaker and industries did not fully understand the risks. We first became aware of the groundwater problems here in the 1980s, after contamination was found in a nearby city drinking water well. After the well impacts were identified, we requested an investigation to determine whether the site was a possible source of the contamination. Long story short, the initial and follow-up investigations confirmed widespread soil and groundwater contamination linked to the historical operations, prompting the need for urgent actions to protect groundwater resources. This photo shows groundwater samples collected at the site in 2016. The distinct yellow color is likely due to high hexavalent chromium concentrations. The figure above is an aerial map of the site showing the locations of soil vapor probes, soil vapor extraction wells, the soil vapor extraction systems, and groundwater monitoring wells. Soil and soil vapor investigations are ongoing both on and off site. There is extensive VOC and chromium impacts in soil extending all the way down to groundwater, more than 350 feet deep. Although the site has been thoroughly investigated over many years, significant work is still needed to address the site complexities. This work includes investigation of emerging contaminants of concern, such as per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, also known as PFAS. This investigation is needed because of historical plating operations. The PFAS soil investigation will occur this year, and depending on the results, additional investigation and remediation may be needed. Staff are reviewing the latest soil vapor testing results, and more testing may be needed to better define the soil vapor plume. This information is important for evaluating potential vapor intrusion risk. Any property located within the soil vapor plume footprint requires vapor intrusion evaluation, which generally includes public outreach and indoor air sampling. It is important to recognize that this work is iterative. These investigations cannot be completed all at once. Because the site is complex and the contamination is widespread, ongoing monitoring and adaptive management are necessary to protect public health. Full characterization and cleanup is required for all contaminants at the site. Soil vapor extraction, SVE, is the soil cleanup method used for VOCs. SVE works like a vacuum. It pulls contaminated air out of the soil, runs it through a treatment system above ground, and then releases the cleaned air. The diagram on this slide shows this process, with the pink areas representing contaminated soil. Here is a magnified view of soil contamination. The brown particles are soil, and the red-orange coating on them is contamination. This contamination can turn into vapor and fill the small air pockets between the soil grains. SVE removes this contaminated vapor and treats it. And as more vapor is removed, the soil becomes cleaner over time. There are two SVE systems targeting different depths. The shallow SVE system targets 0 to 60 feet below the ground, and the deep SVE system targets 100 to 360 feet below the ground. To date, over 50,000 pounds of VOCs have been removed from the shallow zone since system startup in 2003. Over 100,000 pounds of VOCs have been removed from the deep zone since system startup in 2020. Both systems continue to operate, and staff has approved an expansion of the SVE system, which is now underway and will help improve cleanup. In 2016, on-site indoor air testing found PCE and TCE in several buildings at levels above the environmental screening levels, ESLs. To reduce these impacts, an air purification unit was installed inside one of the building units. A subslab depressurization system was installed beneath one building. An SVE was operated to reduce subsurface contamination. Indoor air has been regularly monitored since 2016, with testing now conducted twice a year. The photo on the right is a Sumer canister, the device typically used to collect these air samples. Significant off-site vapor intrusion and mitigation work has also been completed. This map shows the off-site TCE soil vapor plume. Orange represents the areas above the commercial industrial ESL of 100 micrograms per cubic meter. Yellow represents areas above the residential ESL of 16 micrograms per cubic meter. Properties located within the soil vapor plume were selected for vapor intrusion evaluation. Community outreach remains a major challenge, with more than half the properties declining access for sampling. This presents a significant environmental justice concern in this severely disadvantaged community, and we have been working with our Office of Public Engagement, Equity, and Tribal Affairs to build rapport and strengthen trust with this community. Two major rounds of off-site vapor intrusion assessments were completed, the first round in 2018 to 2019, and the second in 2024 to 2025. Air purification units were installed at select properties, including places where VOCs appeared to come from indoor sources rather than vapor intrusion. These air purifiers were later removed upon residents' request. Another round of indoor air sampling is planned for 2026, and additional testing will continue until the risk from the soil vapor plume diminishes. This timeline highlights the major milestones completed each year during the cleanup project. I don't expect you to read every detail. It is simply meant to show key milestones over the past 40 years. A tremendous amount of work has been accomplished, and significant work still remains. Board staff will continue to advance soil cleanup efforts and address vapor intrusion risk. These last few slides were intended to give a brief overview of the complexity of soil and soil vapor contamination, the remediation challenges, vapor intrusion evaluations, and our public outreach efforts. We are happy to provide you with a more in-depth presentation at a future board meeting if interested. With that, we will move into the second part of this presentation. The rest of this presentation focuses solely on groundwater. To provide supporting information for adopting the tentative order for groundwater remediation. A quick refresher. Historical operations resulted in extensive groundwater contamination. The current groundwater plume is over 2.25 miles long and extends past the 60 freeway, spanning two cities. This site was discovered after contamination was found in a nearby city drinking water well. There was an urgent threat to our groundwater resources, and we expedited investigations to determine appropriate remedial actions to protect our water resources. I talked about two urgent risks associated with this site. First was vapor intrusion, covered in part one of this presentation, and the second is drinking water impacts, which is the focus of the rest of this presentation. Three city drinking water wells has been taken out of service because they were contaminated or at risk of becoming contaminated. These wells are shown as small red circles on this map. Protecting water supply became an urgent priority. Under Investigative Order Number 87-146, the responsible party was required to quickly investigate the problem and begin cleanup. Within a decade, the responsible party completed the investigations, installed extensive groundwater remediation infrastructure, and began groundwater pump and treat operations in 1996. The groundwater pump and treat infrastructure is also shown in this map. Groundwater is extracted via two extraction wells, one at the Anza Park and one at the groundwater remediation system location. That water undergoes treatment and is then discharged to either the injection well field or Eli basins. The current groundwater remedy is pump and treat. Contaminated groundwater is pumped to the surface, treated above ground through treatment systems, and then safely discharged. In this diagram, the contaminated groundwater shown in red and pink moves from left to right. An extraction well pumps this water out of the ground. The water is then treated above ground using systems such as air strippers, activated carbon, and ion exchange resins. Once the water meets water quality standards, it is discharged safely through methods like infiltration, injection wells, and publicly owned treatment works. Pump and treat is a critical tool for groundwater protection because it helps prevent groundwater plumes from spreading into other important resources. In a perfect system, all contamination would be captured by the extraction well. However, in reality, several factors can result in incomplete capture. And that is why it is essential to monitor groundwater beyond the extraction well to make sure the system is working. If contamination moves past the capture zone, additional actions, often installation of more extraction wells, are needed to stop the plume from spreading further. Groundwater pump and treat at this site has generally been effective at stopping or slowing most of the groundwater plume. However, recent monitoring shows that contamination has moved beyond the current extraction well network, prompting the need for system upgrades to regain control of the plume and prevent further contamination spread. This is exactly what the tentative order being presented to the board today is intended to address. This map shows our most current understanding of the TCE and hexavalent chromium groundwater plumes. Because this is an important slide, I would like to reorient everyone. The site is the pink rectangle at the top of the maps. Groundwater generally flows to the south, southwest, basically along Euclid Avenue toward the 60 freeway, about 2 miles to the south. The green shading on these maps represents the maximum contaminant levels, MCLs, for each contaminant. Any area with color basically exceeds the MCLs. Think of this like a bullseye. The inner areas are more contaminated. I do also want to point out that this map reflects board staff's interpretation of the groundwater plumes. The responsible party does not fully agree with this depiction, but other interpretations have not been supported with adequate evidence yet. So starting with the TCE plume on the left, the highest concentrations are shown in red, meaning concentrations above 1,000 micrograms per liter, which is 200 times the MCL. The current highest concentration is 14,000 micrograms per liter, about 2,800 times the MCL. Orange represents 500 micrograms per liter, 100 times DMCL, and green represents 5 micrograms per liter, DMCL. On the right is the hexavalent chromium plume. Red represents 500 micrograms per liter, 50 times DMCL. Orange is 100 micrograms per liter, 10 times DMCL. Yellow is 20 micrograms per liter, 2 times DMCL. And green is 10 micrograms per liter, DMCL. I want to highlight the two groundwater extraction wells on this map. EW2, near the middle of the map, is the first line of defense, located near where the former city wells that were taken out of service. This well has been effective at stopping the highest concentrations from moving down gradient. The red portions of the plume do not pass this well. EW1, near the bottom of the map, is the last line of defense and has mostly prevented the orange and green portions of the plume from moving farther south. However, some contamination has moved past this well. At the leading edge, we see TCE concentrations up to 44 micrograms per liter and hexavalent chromium concentrations up to 14 micrograms per liter in exceedance of the MCLs. Farther down gradient of EW1 is an inactive city well. This well was taken offline because of contamination unrelated to the site. There have been discussions about bringing this city well back into service, but doing so will require treating that unrelated contaminant and likely treating contributions from this plume as well. Those discussions are ongoing between the parties involved, but they are not part of the tentative order before the board today. Any contamination that has already moved beyond the extraction wells still needs to be addressed. We will continue coordinating with the responsible party, our Division of Drinking Water, and the city to ensure that happens. The main goal of the tentative order being presented today is to stop any additional contamination from moving past EW1, adding to that detached portion of the plume that has already moved south of the 60 freeway. Groundwater remediation was quickly and successfully implemented to protect important groundwater resources from immediate contamination risk. While the system has been effective overall, the extraction well network is not perfect. The leading edge of the plume has moved beyond the existing extraction wells. To stop further movement of contaminants, system upgrades are necessary. The improvements proposed in the tentative order are essential for enhancing the groundwater pump and treat system and preventing additional downgrading impacts. With that, I would like to turn it over to my co-presenter, Mona Burruss, who will discuss the site-specific groundwater pump and treat system and present the tentative order.
Thank you, Alan. Greetings, Chair Scandura and dear board members. I'm Mona Burruss, and it's my pleasure to be here today and go over some of the highlights of the waste discharge authorization, which is in front of the board for consideration. So, as we learned during this presentation, the selected groundwater remedy for the site is groundwater pump and treat. We learned also that this technology has three main components. One is groundwater extraction, second is treatment, and the third component is discharge. So let's look at all these components for this subject site. So as you can see on the map to the right, the site is located in that pink rectangle to the top. There are currently two extraction wells that are operational, and the first extraction well was installed and is operational since 1996. The second extraction well, which is closer to the site, extraction well number two, was installed and is operational since 2002. A waste discharge authorization was issued for the site in 2011, and since then, the site has been regulated under that waste discharge authorization. Just recently, a third groundwater extraction was installed in the location of extraction well number three, shown southwest of the site. Again, as we learned during this presentation, the groundwater plume originated from the site, moves towards south-southwest. So as we can see on the map, these wells are basically installed and operational in that axis so that they can contain the plume and prevent further degradation of the water quality. So with installation and upon approval of the board members, with the three extraction wells, the total combined flow rate of these extraction wells would be 2,450 gallons per minute. Now, let's see what happens after extraction. Again, on the map to the right, you see the site to the top. Groundwater extracted will be conveyed through a series of pipelines to the groundwater remediation system. As you can see in that simple schematic at the bottom of the slide, after extraction, the groundwater, which is contaminated by contaminants like chromium 6 and volatile organic compound, goes through a series of remediation technologies. The first one is ion exchange technology for removal of chromium 6. After removal of chromium 6, the treated groundwater flows through the liquid activated carbon for removal of VOCs. Then the treated groundwater will be stored in an equalization tank with the volume of 250,000 gallons. So the treatment system at the site is located in West Francis Street. Now, what happens after treatment of the groundwater? Well, by the way, the photo shows the vessels for treatment of the chromium 6 and also the four other vessels for treatment of the VOCs. Each of these basically technologies are arranged in two sets of units in parallel. Okay, the third component of the pump and treat is the discharge. Since operation of this pump and treat system back in 90s, the treated water until the 2011, the treated water was discharged to the Ely basins. Since we have the 2011 waste discharge authorization, the primary method of discharge method of discharge has been through the injection wells. Three injection wells have been installed and have been used for injection of the treated groundwater with certain discharge limitation to the subsurface. Recently, a fourth injection well has been installed and is included in the tentative WDR for board consideration. The total injection flow rate of these injection wells would be 2,000 gallons per minute. So under, as I mentioned, under normal operating condition, the discharge is through injection wells. However, the equalization tank and injection wells require periodic maintenance, backflushing, and cleaning. During those events, the water generated may be discharged to the Ely basins. So as part of the tentative order, which is in front of the board for consideration, we have updated the monitoring and reporting program to include not only the chemicals of concern, including chromium and also VOCs, also other parameters to be monitored. So again, there are discharge limitations to meet the water quality objectives of our basin plan. With that, I appreciate your attention, and I will pass it. Yeah. Oh, yes. This is also a photo showing the location of the equalization tank in South Bonneview Park, and also the three injection wells that are currently operational for discharge of treated water. The fourth injection well is located basically southwest of this map and is proposed in the tentative order. Now, thank you, and I'll pass it to Alan.
Thank you, Mona. This site is one of the most complex contamination sites we manage. It has deep soil columns, multiple discharge areas, and is heavily contaminated with extensive groundwater impacts. This site is located in a severely disadvantaged community. Complete cleanup can take hundreds of years, but we cannot wait to address the immediate risk. Our immediate priority is to protect nearby communities and the environment from the most urgent contamination risk, while moving forward with long-term solutions for lower risk contamination. Immediate threats such as vapor intrusion and drinking water impacts have been and continue to be addressed through proactive remediation and containment measures. Since 1988, the responsible party has spent a little under $100 million, and full cleanup will likely take additional significant costs. The groundwater pump and treat has been operating successfully since 1996, but upgrades are now needed to enhance plume capture. Your decision today on the tentative order is critical. It enables us to strengthen the pump and treat system, maintain momentum, and prevent additional impacts to our groundwater resources. I want to acknowledge our site cleanup program team, Supervisor Mona Baruz, and case managers Alice Nash and George Paredes for their extensive work on this project and the critical work they continue to do. I also want to thank the responsible party and their consultants for their commitment to this cleanup effort. We recognize your dedication, the significant resources you have invested, and your willingness to work with us voluntarily rather than through more formal enforcement actions. This work is important, and we appreciate your collaboration. Finally, I want to acknowledge our partner agencies, including the Division of Drinking Water, the cities, and the permitting agencies, for their vital role in helping us implement and accelerate cleanup efforts. Adopting this tentative order will do a couple things. It will terminate the old order and adopt the new order along with the monitoring and reporting program. Staff recommends that the board adopt the tentative order as presented. Thank you for your time and leadership. Our team is here and we are happy to answer any questions.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to thank our staff for this presentation, Alan and Mona. I had actually asked for this presentation because when I first read this, I looked at it and said, my gosh, this cleanup has taken more than 30 years. And having a little bit of experience in this field, I said, boy, that's a long time. And anybody else would ask that question. So I asked for this presentation to give an overview of the cleanup and just the complexity of the site. That's the first part. And then the second part is, where do the wells that are called for in the WDRs, where do they fit into the overall remedy? So I think you both did a good job at that. So with that, I'd like to ask our board members here if they have any questions. Looks like Board Member Lopez.
Yes, you mentioned that it was impacting towards the 60 freeway. How about the other way, towards the Chino Basin area, Prado Dam? Has it gone that far yet?
Not that we know of. We've only investigated so far, just past the 60 freeway. Not very far, maybe like a quarter mile away. It doesn't look like it's getting beyond half a mile away yet, at least from what I recall. Yeah. But if we don't stop that bleeding, potentially it can move, right? Because that whatever has passed the 60 freeway is not being addressed by the existing groundwater extraction well network. So something has to stop that from spreading further.
It's worth noting that we have a very good understanding of the flow rates of the aquifer in that area. So we can constrain the potential extent of that plume.
Yeah, thank you.
Board Member Clark?
I don't have any questions, but thank you for bringing this to our attention and requesting the presentation. I think just demonstrative of the great work you all do, and it's awesome to be proactive. So thank you for the presentation.
Okay. Our Vice Chair?
A quick question, the outreach, the community outreach, you said it has been a challenge. Have there been workshops, information, language, you know, justice out there to make sure that they understand the risk?
I can take that question first. So, you know, I was actually the case manager of this project in the past, And we had issues with getting engagement from the community. There's not quite of trust for government in the area. We've done a lot of outreach in the area. We had GE, the responsible party, hired a public engagement company to help with the outreach, where they communicate in both English and Spanish to these residents. And we've issued a lot of community fact sheets. We went door to door, knocking on doors to see if anyone wanted to talk about the issues so that we could explain it. We actually had meetings in like residential homes for some of these folks. But the issue is most people don't want to talk to us. And that's something that we've been trying to improve over time. And I think George can help provide some information on that.
Good morning, Chair Scandura and members of the board. My name is George Paredes. I'm an engineering geologist in the site program and currently the case manager. We have been coordinating with OPIDA as the board and coordinating our approach to take for further communication and transparency. Given the political climate, we need to ensure that we're doing it in an appropriate way. This is a predominantly Latino community, so we want to ensure that we're being, health protective, and having a voice for them. And our goal is to also coordinate with city officials and to encourage environmental justice groups as well, locally, and our approach and what is the best way to be able to do that. And ultimately, our goal is just to be able to communicate and have that transparency with them.
Thank you for saying that. I think my only suggestion perhaps would be to even go deeper, right, in our outreach of local or trusted messengers. There has to be a group, C3, maybe a nonprofit group that it's welcome, whatever food bank distribution or anything like that, where they will actually listen. Maybe a local church. Even that, sometimes it works. I know it's difficult. I know it's extra work, but I want to thank you for doing this and bringing the presentation over, but also for all the extended work that you have been doing. Thank you so much.
Okay. And for our board members remotely, Board Member Rue.
I appreciate the work put into this rather lengthy presentation. This is the old Hot Point iron facility. They made flat irons there that people used in their homes that eventually went from Hot Point to GE. So we do know there was a major corporation that was involved with this. And whatever we can do to facilitate this is appreciated. And it is and has been a disadvantaged community for probably 80 years.
Okay. And Board Member Murray.
Thank you. I don't have any questions. I just want to echo my colleagues' comments and appreciation. This is obviously a very dire need, and the amount of outreach to the community members impacted is greatly appreciated. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And then just a couple technical questions and some comments. So the new EW3 that's going to be going in there, is it going to be, I take it it's going to be intercepting the main plume that's coming off of the facility, if I'm not mistaken. Is it also by any chance going to pull back some of that contamination that's broken away and heading down towards the 60 freeway?
So the well is already installed. So yes, so it's going to have a more effective basically impact in capturing the plume that is coming from the upgradient. However, we should not rule out the leading edge of the plume that has already migrated downgradient and may not be captured by the this extraction well.
So it may help retard the flow of that, because that's quite a distance from from the Flatiron plant to
Definitely.
60 freeway.
Correct. If it's within the capture zone of this extraction well, in addition to the basically flow rate that we get from the existing extraction well, yes, it's going to capture that. But the portion that is already past down gradient of the capture zone of this well is basically needs to be addressed using other technologies.
I see. And then the purpose of the injection wells is to just halt the movement of that main plume that's coming off? Is that what the purpose
so
is?
So the injection wells are used to discharge the treated groundwater to the subsurface.
Okay.
So
they have
they
nothing
are looking,
to do with the remediation?
Correct. Okay. Well, the injection wells are a method of discharge of the treated groundwater.
But not to stop or slow down the plume.
That is correct.
Okay. And then just looking at the site, first of all, having grown up in Ontario, I'm very familiar with that site. It was a major employer in the area for decades. It was the old Flatiron plant. It closed because they decided to move the manufacturing overseas. This site, I mean, there are sites on the federal national priorities list, particularly back east, that are less complex than this. So this is a big site. The reason this isn't on the national priorities list is because EPA's policy has been whenever you have a cooperating responsible party and an agency that's willing and able to oversee the cleanup, then they will defer to the state on that. Because certainly going on to the NPL just adds a whole new layer of requirements and process. So certainly this is a much more efficient way of doing this. It is very unfortunate about the vapor intrusion problem, especially that it's extended into the community around there. Unfortunately, this is a problem in many communities, not just disadvantaged communities, but all kinds of communities. There is always a reluctance to, on the part of residents, to allow the agencies and the consultants to come in and actually do vapor sampling. And all I can say is just keep at it, keep working with the residents, use a lot of the staff that are available to help out, as well as some of the things were suggested by our vice chair on that. It's a very unfortunate thing. And then last of all, of course, this is near the Chino Plume, or within the North Chino Bay, or the Chino Basin rather. And already a lot of work is underway to try to remove the agricultural chemicals that are in there, the nitrates and the pesticides and the TDS that's in there to make that a viable groundwater resource. So there's a lot of challenges here. So any further questions or comments, Board Member Lopez?
No, I would just like to add that on the outreach Board Member Alvarado's outreach comment, I think that, you know, you have, since it's Latino predominantly, you have Ontario Hispanic Chamber of Commerce that you might want to, I don't know if it's still active, but I think, you know, you might be able to get in contact with them and they may help you out with some kind of outreach. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so before we go into a motion, Jessica, are there any speaker cards for this item?
No, there are no speaker cards.
Okay, and with that, do I have a motion?
So moved.
Okay, moved by Board Member Lopez, and second?
Second.
Second by Board Member Clark. Jessica, could we have a roll call vote?
Lord Nunder Lopez?
Aye.
Lord Nunder Clark?
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado?
Aye.
Board Member Nuri?
Aye.
Board Member Rue?
Aye.
Chair Scandora?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. Our next item is a basin plan amendment to revise the bacteria total maximum daily load, or TMDL, for the Middle Santa Ana River. And I might mention that as part of this item, there is an errata sheet that is going to be part of any kind of action that's going to be taken by the board today. So I just wanted to call that to everybody's attention. And this item is an action item for the basin plan amendment to revise the bacteria TMDLs for the Middle Santa Ana River. And I'd like to ask Lauren Hubble to give her presentation. Obviously, you're not Lauren.
Not Lauren. Hi, my name's Fabian. I'll be presenting today.
Okay. Thank you, Fabian.
All righty. Good morning, Chair Scandura, members of the board, everyone else. My name is Fabian Tong. I'm an environmental scientist with the Santa Ana Water Control Board. Today, I'm going to be presenting on the Basin Plan Amendment for revising the bacteria total maximum daily loads for the Middle Santa Ana River. Next slide, please. So, just a quick overview and outline of the topics I'm going to be covering today. We'll be starting off with a project purpose. Following that, I will briefly discuss total maximum daily loads, the Middle Santa Ana River watershed and its project's location, some of the watershed impairments, TMDL history. Then I will be talking about the Middle Santa Ana River Task Force. Following that, I will go over details for this proposed revision today and the rationale and technical basis for revising these TMDLs. And then we will be going over public outreach that occurred and some of the public comments that we received. Lastly, we'll get our staff's recommendation for today. Next slide, please. So, starting off with the project purpose, the purpose of this project is to amend the basin plan to revise the bacteria total maximum daily loads for the Middle Santa Ana River. Next slide, please. Total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs, are the maximum amount of a pollutant that a water body can receive and still meet water quality standards. A TMDL accounts for pollutants from all sources. This includes point sources, non-point sources, and a margin of safety. The Clean Water Act, Section 303D, requires that states develop TMDLs for waters that are listed as impaired, meaning they do not meet water quality standards. TMDLs serve as regulatory tools for guiding restoration efforts and ensuring long-term attainment of these standards. In the image on the right, this visual shows how a TMDL is calculated. A TMDL includes the sum of the waste load allocations, including point sources such as wastewater treatment facilities or stormwater discharges, load allocations from non-point sources such as runoff from landscape, runoff from agriculture or natural open areas, and a margin of safety that accounts for uncertainty about the relationship between pollutant loads and the quality of receiving waters. Next slide, please. This slide is showing the Middle Santa Ana River TMDL approval process. Before this presentation today, regional board staff have gone through a series of steps to get here. In the first step, the regional board initiated the California Environmental Quality Act scoping process. This introduced the project. In step two, the regional board, in collaboration with the Middle Santa Ana River TMDL Task Force, which I'll be talking about and introducing later today, developed the TMDL. In step three, the regional board adopts the TMDL, and in step four, the state water board reviews and may approve or revise the TMDL. And finally, the Office of Administrative Law reviews for Clean Water Act enforcement. Next slide, please. Now I'm going to describe the project's location. This slide provides an overview of the Middle Santa Ana River watershed, which is a part of the Santa Ana region. The Middle Santa Ana River watershed, shown here in the red boundary line, encompasses an area of approximately 488 square miles. It is located in the north-central portion of the Santa Ana River watershed. The Middle Santa Ana River watershed includes the southwestern part of San Bernardino County, the northwestern part of Riverside County, and a small portion of Los Angeles County. The Middle Santa Ana River watershed, oh, excuse me, surface water flows shown here in the dark blue lines began in the San Bernardino and San Gabriel Mountains. These mountains are found in the northern portions of this watershed and are shown in the map with these darker contour lines on the top. They generally flow in a northeast to a southwest direction towards the Pacific Ocean. If we're looking at the map, water is flowing from the top right to the bottom left. Historically, this region has been dominated by agricultural land uses. However, over the last couple of decades, we've seen a notable shift towards more urban and suburban developments. Next slide, please. Water bodies in the Middle Santa Ana River support a wide range of beneficial uses designated under our basin plan. These beneficial uses include municipal and domestic water supply, agriculture, groundwater recharge, contact recreation, non-contact recreation, warm freshwater habitat, wildlife habitat, rare, threatened, or endangered species, spawning, reproduction, and development, limited warm freshwater habitat, and commercial and sport fishing. Excuse me. The beneficial uses specific to each water body within the Middle Santa Ana River watershed are shown in this summary table here. A check mark refers to existing or potential beneficial uses. An E indicates that the water body has been specifically accepted from the municipal and domestic water supply designation. A P indicates an existing beneficial use where access is prohibited in some portions. And the U is for unattainable uses. Protecting these beneficial uses is central to our TMDL program. Next slide, please. As previously mentioned, the Clean Water Act, Section 303D, requires states to develop water bodies for, excuse me, requires states to develop TMDLs for water bodies that are identified as impaired, meaning they do not meet water quality standards. In 1994, Chino Creek Reach 1, seen here in yellow, Mill Creek at the Prado area, seen here in pink, were listed as impaired under the Clean Water Act due to high concentrations of indicator bacteria that exceed water quality objectives that are protective of the Rec 1 water contact recreation beneficial use. Later, in 1998, Santa Ana River Reach 3, here in purple, Chino Creek Reach 2, here in dark blue, Cucamonga Creek Reach 1 in green, and Prado Park Lake in red were all also listed for bacteria impairments. Next slide, please. In 2005, TMDLs for bacteria indicators in the Middle Santa Ana River watershed and a phase one implementation plan were adopted through Resolution R8 2005-0001. During the process to adopt the Middle Santa Ana River TMDLs, it was recognized that the protection of recreational uses during dry summer conditions was a higher priority than the protection of recreational uses during wet winter conditions, simply because recreational activity was more likely to occur during the dry season. For this reason, separate compliance schedules were established. For the dry summer conditions, which is from April 1st through October 31st, the E. coli TMDLs for E. coli were to be met no later than December 31st, 2015. And for wet winter conditions, which range from November 1st through March 31st, TMDLs for E. coli were to be met no later than December 31st, 2025. Next slide, please. The Middle Santa River TMDL Task Force was established in 2006 to approach the Middle Santa Ana River TMDL with a collaborative effort that would coordinate TMDL implementation and share technical and financial responsibility. The task force brings together a diverse group of stakeholders, including cities, counties, water agencies, agricultural operators, and state partners. Participating entities, shown here in the middle of this table, work together towards one common goal: improving water quality in the Middle Santa Ana River. This joint effort enables shared funding, coordinated implementation, and consistent monitoring across jurisdictions. Next slide, please. The Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority, or SAPA, serves as the administrator for the Middle Santa Ana River TMDL Task Force. SAPA is a joint powers authority that delivers regional water solutions supporting its member agencies. SAPA supports the Middle Santa Ana River TMDL Task Force in planning, designing, and implementing projects to improve water quality. While the task force stakeholders directly fund TMDL implementation activities, SAPA works with stakeholders to secure reliable funding to operate and maintain water quality improvement projects. I would like to acknowledge and ESAPA staff, as well as task force members present here today, and just thank them for their continued support and collaboration in our efforts here. Next slide, please. As mentioned previously, we are proposing to revise the Middle Santa Ana River bacteria TMDLs. This proposed revision for the Middle Santa Ana River TMDLs would extend the wet winter conditions compliance deadline from December 31st, 2025 to December 31st, 2035. This 10-year extension is necessary. This allows more time to develop a better understanding of bacterial sources during wet weather flows. And this proposed revision also establishes a phase two implementation plan to facilitate efforts to comply with the TMDLs, the waste load allocations, and load allocations for the wet winter conditions by the proposed new compliance deadline. The proposed revision will not be modifying any water quality objectives. Next slide, please. This slide is describing the justification for this TMDL revision. Since the 2005 TMDLs were adopted, phase one implementation activities have been completed. Water quality goals remain unmet for both the dry summer and wet winter conditions. And to date, Middle Santa Ana River TMDL implementation activities have focused on efforts to comply with the dry summer conditions. This is from April 1st through October 31st, again, when recreational activity is more likely to occur in the watershed. Since 2007, findings from the studies have demonstrated the challenges of achieving compliance under these dry weather flows. But there are also significant challenges with achieving compliance during wet winter conditions, which is from November 1st through March 31st. Given the increased volume of water expected to be managed during wet weather flows, the challenge of complying is expected to be orders of magnitude greater compared to dry weather flows. Due to these challenges to collect data during wet weather flows, and because TMDL implementation activities have focused on dry summer conditions, data for wet winter conditions is currently limited. Next slide, please. The phase two implementation plan proposes 13 tasks to be completed by December 31st, 2035 compliance deadline. I would like to highlight a few of these tasks that the board may be interested in. Task number five, that is a study for the application of high flow suspension. High flow suspension, which temporarily suspends recreational standards during high surface water flows, is currently in our basin plan and applies to Santa Ana River Reach 3. Task five will investigate if and how high flow suspension could be applied not only to Santa Ana River Reach 3, but to other water bodies within the Middle Santa Ana River watershed. Results from this study will provide valuable information needed for a future revision. Another task I would like to highlight is task number six. Task number six is a study to collect bacteria-related data during wet weather flows to identify specific activities, operations, and processes in urban or agricultural areas that may be contributing to controllable sources of bacterial indicators. Results from this task will help inform if sources of bacteria during wet weather flows pose a significant risk to human health and if these sources should be prioritized for mitigation. Next slide, please. Continuing with the phase two TMDL implementation plan, the final task I would like to highlight is task number 10. This task will be reopening and revising the Middle Santa Ana River TMDLs. This is an important task for this proposed revision, and I will be going over it in more detail in the following slide. Next slide, please. Task number 10, which will reopen and revise the Middle Santa Ana River bacteria TMDLs, is set to begin no later than 2 years after the effective date of this proposed revision. Findings from the phase two studies will help support this future TMDL revision. Since 2005 TMDLs were adopted, the State Water Board has adopted the Inland Surface Waters, Enclosed Bays, and Estuaries of California bacteria provisions. These provisions are intended to apply to all waters with a REC 1 beneficial use and will need to be included in a future TMDL revision. Additionally, future TMDL revisions will include, but are not limited to, clarifying compliance schedules for dry summer and wet winter conditions. As mentioned earlier, dry summer conditions refer to the date range of April 1st through October 31st, and wet winter conditions refer to the date range of November 1st through March 31st. The future revision will base compliance schedules on weather rather than current seasonal date ranges. We would also include a definition for dry weather. This would allow for clear distinctions between wet and dry weather. And because land uses within the Middle Santa Ana River watershed continue to shift towards more urban and suburban development, we will need to update the land use characteristics accordingly. Finally, the future revision will establish a phase three implementation plan. This will employ the results from the phase two implementation plan and create a framework to implement wet weather source prioritization strategies, update watershed management plans, and other resources necessary for achieving TMDL attainment. Next slide, please. I would now like to highlight some of the efforts we've taken to engage the public throughout this revision process. In 2023, the Santa Ana Water Board initiated the California Environmental Quality CEQA scoping process. This included a public meeting to engage stakeholders and receive feedback on the scope and direction of the proposed revisions. That same year, staff solicited consultation with California Native American tribes through AB 52 tribal outreach. There has been also ongoing efforts for AB 2108 outreach. This calls for outreach in disadvantaged communities that are disproportionately impacted by water quality pollution. In the map on the right, you will see the locations of disadvantaged communities in the Middle Santa Ana River watershed. This map was created using CalEnviroScreen, and we used the poverty percentage indicator. All areas with 80% or greater score for this indicator are shown here in red and orange. These areas with 80% or greater score for this poverty percentage indicator were targeted for AB 2108 outreach. Next slide, please. A public comment period for the proposed TMDL revision was held from January 27th, 2026 to February 26th, 2026. This input, this provided a full 30-day window for stakeholder input. During the formal comment period, Santa Ana Water Board received two written formal comments, one from a member of the public and another from Orange County Coastkeeper. All comments were reviewed and addressed as part of this final consideration process. A response to comment document has been included in your agenda packet as well as posted on our Middle Santa Ana River TMDL webpage. Next slide, please. This concludes my presentation on the proposed TMDL resolution. Staff recommend the board adopt Resolution R8-2026-0014 as presented with the changes shown in this errata sheet. This errata sheet change has also been included in your agenda packet as well as posted on our Middle Santa Ana River TMDL page. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them now. If any further follow-up or any details are needed, please feel free to reach out to Lauren Hubble. Her information's on the slide via email or phone. And thank you for your time and consideration.
Well, thank you very much, Fabian. Thank you very much for the presentation. And board members, do we have any questions or comments, beginning with those here in the room? Board Member Lopez.
Yes. On slide six, you said historically dominated by agriculture. Has the impact of dairies and egg ranches been taken into account somewhere?
Sorry. Yes, we've actually worked with our CAFO and agricultural staff, and that's been included in our total maximum daily load revision.
Because it didn't say it here, that's why I was curious.
Any other questions? Or Member Clark?
Thank you for the presentation. You mentioned the outreach efforts, and just based on the last presentation, they cited hiring an outside firm to help with those efforts. I don't think I heard that referenced in your presentation, but if I did, could you just articulate whether it was done in-house or whether we got extra help?
No, all outreach was done in-house. The CEQA scoping process, I was not personally a part of, but for AB 2108, as far as reaching out to disadvantaged communities, I was. We went to various areas that were in the Middle Santa Ana River watershed. We stopped by parks, community centers, even some like YMCA, stuff like that. We posted our flyers and talked with anybody that was willing to talk with us.
Great, thank you.
Question. Okay. Any questions from our board members who are participating remotely? Board Member Rue.
No, it was a fairly thorough presentation. I am buoyed by the fact that we only had two comments from the public. This means we are doing our job as outreach. Thank you.
And Board Member Murray.
Agree. No, I agree with Board Member Rue and everyone's comments, but clearly we are right on target with the minimal feedback from the public. So great presentation. Thank you for the incredible work and no questions at this time.
Then I just had, well, I guess a question or a comment, and that is certainly when I looked at this report, the first thing I wanted to say was, well, okay, fine, we need to address these wet weather conditions, but even though we implemented all the tasks on dry weather, we still haven't met all the TMDLs on dry weather. So now, one thing I did look at is that one of the tasks, I think it's task number three, we're still going to look at some of the dry weather issues and problems that have occurred.
Yes, that is correct. So, task three, that is to revise the existing watershed implementation plans for the dry summer condition TMDLs. In addition to task three, we are already currently working with the Middle Santa River TMDL Task Force on some more comprehensive source assessments during dry weather. And in the latest 2026 triennial report, they actually have some findings re and a related study posted already. So there's already currently efforts that are ongoing, and we hope to add that with task three to come into attainment.
Okay, and then another thing I notice is that I think one of our tasks, I think it's task number 10, which is going to start in the next couple of years, we're actually going to reopen and revise begin the process of reopening and revising these TMDLs entirely. But we need to complete some of these tasks first before we get there.
Correct. A lot of these tasks are meant to kind of build upon each other. This task 10, we like to think of it as if we're refining it rather than revision. It's kind of a nuanced word, so we like to think of as if it's we're refining it. We're making it better. These tasks and these studies are going to be used in this future revision, and so we're all shooting towards that goal of this future revision, and we're implementing any new regulatory actions, and as well as anything we learn from these studies.
And that'll be very important because when these TMDLs were first adopted back in 2006, the population was about 1 million people in the Inland Empire, or in this region, this area. Today, it's 1.75 million, and so as a result, there's a lot more residential development. There are, of course, all the different warehouses and other developments that are out there. This has increased impervious surface, so it's made it much more difficult to comply with these TMDLs. Had it not been for all this growth, there's a pretty good chance we would have met the TMDLs for both dry weather and wet weather. So it is definitely a challenge. So, any further questions or comments from our board members? So, with that, and again, as I mentioned, we have an errata sheet. That errata sheet is online as well as also here if the public would like to look at it. But I do request a motion and a second with the errata sheet. So, do I
Chair
have a motion?
Scandura, we have two speakers.
Oh, I'm sorry. I overlooked that.
Okay, so the first speaker is going to be Tess Dunham on Zoom, followed by Johanna Reynolds in person.
Good morning. Are you able to hear me?
Absolutely.
Thank you. My name is Tess Dunham. I am with Consories and Conway in Sacramento, but more importantly, I serve as the regulatory facilitator to the Middle Santa Ana River Bacteria TMDL Task Force. We are in full support of the amendments happening here today and wanted to just thank your staff for their continued collaboration and work with the task force. We consider us all in it together. We know we have significant challenges ahead with respect to bacteria in the watershed to make sure the Middle Santa Ana River is safe for all of those that recreate in it. We know it is an important local resource. Bacteria, in particular, to Chair Scandera's comments just moments before, is very difficult. It is a statewide issue as well. And in fact, there are a number of efforts at the State Water Resources Control Board and across the state with stormwater agencies looking to see how we can collectively address the challenges associated with bacteria, considering the sources are both natural as well as anthropogenic. But again, here today just to support and to thank your staff for their diligence in working with the task force and to continue to support the collaborative efforts we have in this task force and across all of the task forces. Happy to answer any questions, but just wanted to make sure you know the task force is here and in full support.
Well, thank you, Ms. Dunham, and our second speaker.
Hi, everybody. My name is Joanna Ramos. I'm the Managing Director at Inland Empire Waterkeeper, and I'm also representing Orange County Coast Keeper. We just wanted to reaffirm our public comment and show support to the current 10-year proposed 10-year extension. As we all know, it's getting hotter here in the Inland Empire, so the Middle Santa Ana River and its tributaries are extremely important sites for the communities that rely on it to cool down during these summer months. So we're looking forward to we're showing our support here, but also getting a safer and more accessible river for the public. So just wanted to thank the staff and the task force, and we're here to support. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ramos. Any other public comments?
No, they're not.
Okay. Now we can get to requesting a motion in a second with the errata sheet. Do I have a motion?
So move.
Okay. Moved by Board Member Lopez.
Second.
And second by Vice Chair Alvarado. Could we have a roll call?
Board Member Lopez.
Aye.
Board Member Clark.
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado.
Aye.
Board Member Nuri.
Aye.
Board Member Rue.
Aye.
Chair Scandora.
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We are now going to be moving into our two. We have two public hearings today on liability complaints. But before we do that, we need about a 10-minute break to set everything up. So we're going to take a break. Okay, we're going to go ahead and continue the meeting. And we have all of our board members present, including those who are participating remotely. Our next item number 9, is going to be a hearing on the administrative civil liability for Robinson Manufacturing. But before we open that hearing, there has been a request by the representatives of Robinson Manufacturing, and so I'd like to turn it over to our attorney. Rocklio.
Thank you, Chair Scandura. This morning, the advisory team received a request for postponement of the hearing from Robinson Manufacturing's consultant, who's here today. The prosecution team has requested an opportunity to address the board on the procedural request. Consultant is also here for the respondent to receive the request. And with that, I return the procedural matter to the chair.
Okay. And I believe the respondent's representative wanted to make comments. I make a statement.
Good morning, sir. Good morning, board. Last evening, about 4:18.
If you could state your name for the record, sir, and who you represent.
Glenn Pallas, okay. GLEN, last name Pallas, here for Robinson MFG Incorporated. Okay. We're requesting an extension or postponement of this hearing. Last evening at 4:18 p.m., I received a call that Mr. Robinson was admitted to the hospital. I have limited scope as far as what I'm able to do on his behalf. Therefore, I redirected to this and I'm making that request at this time. That's the only point that I have before this thing due to the medical situation. I have no idea to the degree and the extent of what the condition is at this point in time. And I will keep the board posted as to what is proceeding.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Pallas. And I understand that the prosecution team would also like to make comments.
Good morning, Board Chair, members of the board. Is that working? Good morning, Board Chair, members of the board. Catherine Ha, counsel for the prosecution team. We'll take just a couple of minutes to address this procedural request. I understand the medical situation, and our request essentially is that this hearing be continued until the April 24th board meeting. Our staff is available to proceed and present this item at that time. I would like to note for clarity in the record that some of the email correspondence which has transpired between Mr. Pallas and the advisory team over the last couple of days has indicated that the prosecution team has been difficult to meet with and otherwise unavailable to Robinson Manufacturing, Inc. And I'd like to clarify for the record that there was a meeting, which is the subject of Mr. Pallas's email, which he alleges did not proceed and was changed at the last moment. That is not how that event transpired. And in fact, that meeting did proceed and Mr. Pallas participated in that meeting, a settlement conference on behalf of Robinson Manufacturing, Inc. To the extent that the prosecution team needs to meet with Robinson Manufacturing moving forward or answer any questions of the discharger, we remain steadfastly available to earnestly engage in those good faith negotiations. And so I just make our staff available to Mr. Pallas and Mr. Robinson, who's not here today, to meet if needed going forward. And with that, the request would be to schedule this for April 24th. And I have nothing else to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Board members, do you have any questions or comments? Board Member Lopez.
Yes, since this is a public hearing and you know, it's for the, not just for the staff and applicant, but for the public, does any item has to be republished, re-noticed, anything in the public?
Yes, it will be re-agendized.
Oh, it will?
If the board decides to postpone and moves to postpone the hearing, it will be put on a new agenda for the April. Well, depending on what the board's motion is, it will be put on a new agenda.
And perhaps I can just clarify that if it is the board's direction, the prosecution team is prepared to proceed today.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Remotely, Board Member Rue or Board Member Murray?
I am prepared to wait until the 24th. I think it's only right, if we're going to do this, that we have all parties present.
Okay. I'd like to propose a motion then that we postpone this item to the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board's April 24th meeting. And the location of that meeting is in
Irvine.
In Irvine, I believe at the Irvine Ranch Water District offices. So that would be my proposed motion. Do I have a motion?
I'll make the motion.
Okay. And a second.
I will second it.
Okay. So it's been moved and second. You can have a roll call.
Thornender Lopez.
Aye.
Thornender Clark.
Aye.
Vice Chair Alvarado.
Aye.
Thornender Nuri.
Aye.
Thornender Rue.
Aye.
And Chair Scandora.
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you.
Okay. Well, our next item is the Administrative Civil Liability Complaint Hearing for Wicked Creations. And before we start that hearing, we're going to need just a few minutes, a very, very short break to set up for that one. Okay, our meeting continues. So our next item is item number 10, which is the Administrative Civil Liability Complaint Hearing for Wicked Creations. This is the time and place for the hearing in the matter of the Administrative Civil Liability Complaint R8-2025-0066 issued to Wicked Creations Incorporated, proposing a penalty of $150,000 based on allegations from the discharger violated provisions of the Water Code by failing to obtain appropriate regulatory coverage for its industrial operations under the general permit for stormwater discharges associated with industrial activities, order number 2018-0028-D. DWQ, the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Permit, CAS 50001, or otherwise for the facility located at 13832 West Street in the city of Garden Grove. I'm John Scandura, Chair of the Santa Ana Water Board. Here with me in person are Vice Chair Gloria Alvarado, Board Members Leticia Clark and Al Lopez. Board Members Bill Rue and Chris Murray are attending this meeting remotely on Zoom. This hearing is being conducted as a hybrid meeting with an option for the public to participate via Zoom. The board is being advised by Supervising Engineering Geologist Alan Kwok, Heraclio Pimentel, attorney for the Santa Ana Water Board, and Desta Matsuda, attorney for the Santa Ana Water Board. The advisory team has not had any substantive conversations regarding the issues involved in this proceeding with the prosecution staff or with Wicked Creations. Members of the prosecution team include Eric Lindberg, executive officer for this water board, Brian Covalone, assistant executive officer, Michelle Beckwith, senior environmental scientist, David Rosas, an environmental scientist, and Nick Amini, supervising water resources control engineer. Carson Capps, attorney with the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement, and Catherine Haw, attorney with the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement. Neither the prosecution team staff nor attorneys are advising the Santa Ana Water Board in this matter. The prosecution team is a party to this proceeding. Is there anybody here for Wicked Creations, either here or online? Okay. The official, and I'll be asking this a number of times throughout the hearing, the official record of the testimony at this hearing will be created by our court reporter. This hearing is also recorded. At the end of this hearing, the Santa Ana Water Board will close the hearing in this matter, and the board will deliberate on the evidence. The board may adjourn to closed session to consider the evidence received and deliberate on a decision. After considering the evidence, the Santa Ana Water Board will make findings of fact and conclusions of law and determine whether to impose the proposed civil liability, impose a higher or lower amount, or decline to impose any liability. All written evidence was required to be received by the applicable deadlines in the revised hearing procedure. The prosecution team submitted timely evidence and argument. The respondent did not submit evidence or argument. The board did not receive any comments from non-parties or any evidentiary objections from the parties. Having received no objections, all materials that were received by the deadlines are hereby made as part of this record. If the parties use speaking notes or any visual aids illustrating previously submitted evidence with their presentation, those will be made part of the record, and no other documentary evidence will be accepted into the record unless the board makes a specific ruling to allow it. If you intend to make a public comment on this item, please submit a speaker card. The hearing will be conducted in accordance with the revised hearing procedure and the order of proceedings, and will proceed as follows. First, the prosecution team's presentation of evidence. Then Wicked Creations may cross-examine the prosecution team's witnesses. Next, presentation of Wicked Creations evidence. And then the prosecution team may cross-examine Wicked Creations witnesses. Thereafter is any rebuttal by the prosecution team, followed by cross-examination or additional rebuttal testimony by Wicked Creations, if any. We will then receive public comments with a three-minute time limit for each commenter, followed by questions from the board and the advisory team. Then we will receive prosecution team's closing statement, followed by Wicked Creations' closing statement. Any party wishing to present an opening statement should do so at the beginning of the evidentiary presentation. Any party wishing to conduct or recross examination should request permission to do so at an appropriate time. The prosecution team and Wicked Creations each have 30 minutes for their presentations, cross examination, and closing statements. The board members and the advisory team may ask questions of the parties add witnesses at any time. Time spent answering questions will not be deducted from the party's 30-minute allotments. So, I will now administer the oath. If you intend to provide testimony in this matter, please stand, raise your right hand, or turn to the camera and raise your right hand if you're on Zoom. Stand. Do you solemnly state under penalty of perjury that the evidence that you shall give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Thank you. All persons presenting testimony must state their name and whether they have taken the oath before testifying. So, we will now go into the prosecution team's presentation.
Thank you, Chair Scandura, and good morning. I'm Eric Lindberg, the prosecuting officer for this case, and I've taken the oath. We're here because there is repeated noncompliance with basic requirements, We are here because when there is repeated noncompliance with basic requirements, escalation to formal enforcement is necessary. Wicked Creations has been operating an industrial facility without enrolling under the Stormwater Industrial General Permit for years. This results in substantial harm to our regulatory program, as they are operating without being subject to any of the requirements contained in the Stormwater Permit. This results in an unfair economic advantage over industrial facilities that are in compliance with the Stormwater Permit. This also results in potential harm to the beneficial uses of surface waters in our region, as stormwater discharges carrying metals and other pollutants from the facility go unidentified, unmanaged, and unmitigated by best management practices. The civil liability complaint before you today carries significant fines, and collecting fines is never our goal. Fines exist as a deterrent when compliance assistance and enforcement mechanisms fail to bring a discharger into compliance. As is our staff's regular practice, Wicked Creations has received significant compliance assistance since being identified as a non-filer, including attempted inspections and extensive correspondence with the Santa Ana Water Board staff. In addition, the prosecution team issued a complaint to Wicked Creations in July of 2024, seeking the mandatory minimum penalty for their failure to enroll. This effort led to a hearing before the Santa Ana Water Board in October of 2024. Where the board adopted Order R8-2024-0038 and assessed a penalty of $7,376. Wicked Creations did not appear at that hearing, and to date they still have not enrolled under the Industrial General Permit nor paid any administrative civil liability. Wicked continues to flout environmental regulations and drain board resources. The evidence we present to you today is straightforward. California Water Code requires industrial facilities that conduct industrial activities to obtain appropriate regulatory coverage prior to operation. Wicked Creations is such an industrial facility and has still not obtained appropriate regulatory coverage. They have not presented any evidence to contradict this conclusion. Even so, the prosecution team has carefully put together a case which satisfies our burden of proof. We will show how staff engaged in meaningful and repeated outreach over the years, trying to assist Wicked Creations in obtaining appropriate regulatory coverage. We will show how these violations are especially important to avoid in disadvantaged and environmental justice communities. We will show that the proposed liability is reasonable and supported by the facts. My team will now present the evidence, and I apologize that once again the respondent has not shown up to address the board. That's very unfortunate. David Rosas, please.
Good morning, Board Chair. Good morning. Hello. Good morning. Good morning, Board Chair Scandura and members of the board. My name is David Rosas, and I have taken the oath. And I am an environmental scientist in the General Stormwater Unit for the Santa Ana Water Board. Today, I'll be discussing the proposed administrative civil liability complaint for Wicked Creations, Inc. Next slide, please. Before I begin my presentation, I believe it is important to briefly identify what we are discussing today. I'll start by going over the Industrial General Permit and the significance of obtaining permit coverage. Then I will discuss Wicked Creations' background information as it relates to stormwater. Lastly, I will lay out Santa Ana Water Board staff's enforcement efforts against Wicked Creations, which will lead us to discussing today's proposed administrative civil liability complaint. Next slide, please. Wicked Creations is a facility in the Santa Ana region that requires industrial general permit coverage but has failed to obtain it. I will be discussing why they require permit coverage in a moment. Despite continuous compliance assistance and enforcement efforts by the Santa Ana Water Board staff to obtain compliance, Wicked Creations has failed to obtain permit coverage. This is significant because unpermitted facilities create economic and water quality impacts for the local community due to their failure to pay for and implement a stormwater protection program. Next slide. The Industrial General Permit is a National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES permit, under the Federal Clean Water Act. This permit regulates stormwater discharges and authorized non-stormwater discharges from industrial facilities in California. Permit coverage is required for industrial facilities with a standard industrial classification, or SIC code, that is listed in Attachment A of the Industrial General Permit. Facilities must self-report an SIC code from OSHA's SIC manual that describes the facility's industrial activity. Some examples of industrial facilities listed in Attachment A are manufacturing facilities, transportation facilities, and recycling facilities. The goal is to improve water quality in the state by addressing the pollutants to stormwater discharges associated with industrial activities. These pollutants are carried to rivers, streams, lakes, and the ocean through stormwater and non-stormwater runoff and can threaten and adversely affect human health and the environment. Next slide. In order to improve water quality, the Industrial General Permit requires regulated facilities to develop a facility-specific stormwater pollution prevention plan with a representative monitoring program. The facility's stormwater plan documents the best management practices, or BMPs, that the facility will implement on-site. These BMPs are practices that help reduce or prevent stormwater pollutant discharge, and a facility's BMPs can range from good housekeeping, such as sweeping, to installing advanced treatment systems. The BMPs the facility choose are dependent on the facility's pollutant levels. The Industrial General Permit requires stormwater sampling for pollutants generated by the facility's industrial activity. Unpermitted facilities do not participate in these essential water quality improvement requirements. Next slide. Wicked Creations operates a manufacturing facility identified on the map located at 13832 West Street in the city of Garden Grove. The facility is located in an area of Garden Grove designated for industrial use as indicated by the light blue region of the color-coded land use map created by the city of Garden Grove. Next slide. Wicked Creations receiving water is the East Garden Grove Winterbergs channel and was subject to an interim approved jurisdictional determination from the United States Army Corps of Engineers on April 22, 2019, which determined the channel to be a traditionally navigable water and therefore a water of the United States under the current regulatory definition promulgated by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. This slide depicts Wicked Creations' proximity to the nearest storm drain, which directly discharges into the East Garden Grove Winterbergs channel. The receiving water discharges to the Bolsa Chica Ecological Preserve. Next slide. Wicked Creations is an active industrial facility that manufactures metal hardware, specifically automotive hardware products. You can see some of Wicked Creations products posted to their Facebook page as of July 30th, 2025. Wicked Creations industrial activity is best described under SIC code 3429. Santa Ana Water Board staff identified the discharger's SIC code based on the business's online posting and their business license that they filed with the City of Garden Grove. SIC code 3429 is included as manufacturing facility in Attachment A of the Industrial General Permit, which would require Wicked Creations to obtain coverage under said permit. The discharger remained active and in business during the period of the alleged violation. As you can see, the company was advertising a Labor Day sale on August 28, 2025 on their website. Note this website, Facebook screenshot, and business license are identified as prosecution team's exhibits 30, 31, and 16, respectively. Next slide. Santa Ana Water Board staff visited Wicked Creations facility three times. However, staff was only able to inspect the facility during the most recent visit on August 28, 2025, as previous attempts to conduct inspections were denied. Santa Ana Water Board staff observed industrial activities occurring at the location with industrially sourced pollutants exposed to stormwater, as identified as Prosecution Team Exhibit Number 20. Wicked Creations generates metal shavings, such as aluminum, that have been observed tracked out onto West Street, as identified as Prosecution Team's Exhibit Number 3. Without permit coverage, these and other pollutants the facility generates go unidentified without best management practices to reduce their pollutant levels and ultimately discharge into local receiving waters. Next slide. Wicked Creations industrial activity and associated water quality issues is occurring in a disadvantaged community. This slide is a screenshot of Wicked Creations location from the CalEnviro Screen website. The darker orange tracks are the symbology used by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, or OEHA, to illustrate a high overall percentile score for the area. Now, what does this mean? High percentiles identify disadvantaged communities with high pollutant burdens and vulnerable populations. Wicked Creations violation exacerbates the already occurring environmental issues documented in this disadvantaged community. Next slide. Now I will go over our agency's statutory authority as it relates to Wicked Creations' previous enforcement efforts, specifically the enforcement that led up to an administrative civil liability order that the board adopted in October 2024, which imposed a mandatory minimum penalty. The Stormwater Enforcement Act requires that regional boards identify facilities who have not obtained the required permit coverage or who have failed to comply with reporting requirements as expressed in NBDS permits. For the types of violations covered by this act, the regional board issues two notices of noncompliance, which explain the violation and provide direction on how to correct the violation. Together, the two notices, as required by this act, give dischargers 60 days to come into compliance without penalty. If, after receipt of two notices of noncompliance in 60 days, the discharger has not corrected the violation, the Act requires the Regional Board to issue a complaint for a mandatory minimum penalty. Next slide. To be clear, the Wicked Creations Administrative Civil Liability complaint brought before the Board by the Santa Ana Water Board Prosecution Team today does not fall under the Stormwater Enforcement Act, but instead, the Prosecution Team is asserting our legal authority pursuant to Water Code Section 13376 and 13385. In relevant part, Water Code Section 13376 requires a person who discharges pollutants or proposes to discharge pollutants to navigable waters of the United States to file a report of the discharge. For industrial facilities like Wicked Creations, this report would result in enrollment in the industrial general permit, which must be filed before industrial activities begin. Next slide. Water Code Section 13385 authorizes the Regional Board to issue the proposed administrative civil liability complaint for dischargers who fail to enroll under the industrial general permit. Specifically, Water Code Section 13385 subdivision A1 provides for civil liability for a person who violates Water Code Section 13376. Violation of Water Code Section 13385 under Subdivision C1 authorizes a monetary penalty of up to $10,000 for each day in which the violation occurs. Furthermore, Water Code Section 13385 requires the Regional Board to take into consideration certain factors when determining the amount of the civil liability. The proposed civil liability amount is calculated based on the State Water Resource Control Board's Water Quality Enforcement Policy. I will discuss those calculations in a later slide. Section 13385 ensures that violations carry meaningful consequences to protect water quality and maintain compliance across the regulated community. Next slide. I will now go through Wicked Creations enforcement history, starting with the issued notices of noncompliance. On December 6, 2023, Santa Ana Water Board staff issued a notice of noncompliance to the discharger for the violation alleged in this complaint. The notice informed the discharger that they were in violation of the water code due to their failure to obtain permit coverage. The notice had a deadline of January 4th to obtain permit coverage and stated that a failure to do so would result in a mandatory minimum penalty. On January 4th, 2024, Santa Ana Water Board staff issued a second notice of noncompliance to the discharger because permit coverage was not obtained by the deadline specified in the first notice. The second notice reiterated the requirement to obtain permit coverage and gave a final deadline of February 3rd, 2024 to obtain permit coverage, or the regional board would assess a mandatory minimum penalty. These notices are identified as prosecution team's exhibits number 5 and 6. Next slide. Now, outreach is important to the prosecution team, and this slide illustrates the multiple attempts made to communicate with Wicked Creations. Each phone call was initiated by Santa Ana Water Board staff, where staff would explain to Wicked Creations representatives the notices of noncompliance, state the deadline for the notices, explain the mandatory minimum penalty, and provide information on how to obtain permit coverage. When staff left voicemail reminders, no return calls were received. These phone calls are identified as prosecution team's exhibits 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. Next slide. After the notices of noncompliance were issued and the deadlines had passed, on March 27, 2024, the Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team issued a conditional settlement offer for $5,000 plus staff costs to Wicked Creations, which went unanswered. In our continued outreach attempts on April 22nd and April 24th, Santa Ana Water Board staff left voicemails for Wicked Creations regarding the conditional settlement offer, which also went unanswered. On June 7, 2024, Santa Ana Water Board staff attempted to perform an inspection of Wicked Creations, but was again denied by a Wicked Creations representative. On July 29, 2024, as part of our progressive enforcement efforts, Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team sent mandatory minimum penalty complaint number R8 2024-0038 to Wicked Creations, which identified violations of the California Water Code. The complaint proposed an administrative civil liability in the amount of $7,376, as authorized by Water Code Section 13399.33A1. This monetary penalty differed from the conditional settlement offer due to the increased staff costs in developing the mandatory minimum penalty complaint. The complaint was adopted by this board on October 25th, 2024. Three payment collection notices were issued to Wicked Creations with no response received. To date, Wicked Creations still has not obtained permit coverage under the Industrial General Permit, despite Wicked Creations' website still being active and failed to pay the mandatory minimum penalty. Note the above-mentioned items are prosecution team exhibits 12, 13, 14, 15, 21, and 22. Next slide. This timeline illustrates the efforts made by Santa Ana Water Board staff as discussed in the previous slides. The timeline begins with the first issued notice of noncompliance in December 2023 and ends with the administrative civil liability complaint issuance date in September 2025. As shown, staff made significant outreach efforts spanning the course of many months. These efforts took the form of letters, phone calls, and in-person inspections, or rather, attempted in-person inspections. The yellow triangles denote the phone calls between Santa Ana Water Board staff and the discharger. The blue dots denote the remaining enforcement events taken by Santa Ana Water Board staff. Due to the facility's continuing failure to obtain permit coverage, Santa Ana Water Board staff issued the administrative civil liability complaint being presented today. Next slide. Due to Wicked Creations' continued lack of compliance, Santa Ana Water Board staff conducted a third inspection in preparation of issuing the administrative civil liability complaint. On August 28, 2025, Santa Ana Water Board staff coordinated a joint inspection with the City of Garden Grove and was granted access by Ms. Miles, who was now identified as Ms. Poston, Staff observed Wicked Creation signage on site and industrial activity occurring at the site, which was indicative of activities requiring enrollment under the industrial general permit. Staff observed metal material and scrap metal stored outdoors exposed to stormwater. Staff noted multiple potential stormwater quality issues, including poor housekeeping, oil spills without spill kit deployment, and material track out. Based on Wicked Creation's history and Santa Ana Water Board staff's inspection, the Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team issued the administrative civil liability complaint on September 15, 2025. This administrative civil liability complaint is identified as prosecution team's exhibit number 41. Next slide. I will now present the Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team's administrative civil liability complaint against Wicked Creations. Wicked Creations is alleged to have violated the California Water Code for failure to obtain permit coverage. The prosecution team calculates Wicked Creations' days of violation as 508 days. The start date was April 26, 2024, the day after Wicked Creations' conditional settlement offers deadline, to September 15, 2025, the date the complaint was issued. Under Water Code Section 13385, Subdivision C1, a person in violation of Water Code Section 13376 is subject to an administrative civil liability of up to $10,000 per day. Although the penalty may be up to $10,000 per day, the Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team is exercising its enforcement discretion and proposing a civil liability amount of $150,000. I will explain our calculations in the coming slides. Next slide. Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team calculated Wicked Creations' administrative civil liability complaint penalty amount using the methodology established by State Water Resource Control Board's 2024 Water Quality Enforcement Policy. The enforcement policy has a 10-step process to calculate the proposed penalty. These next two slides show that the Santa Ana Water Board prosecution team went through said process, though the individual calculations and factors did not determine the proposed final liability amount. Therefore, I will not be going into detail about individual factors. However, I can explain further if needed. This slide shows Wicked Creations' base liability amount. Wicked Creations has a maximum $10,000 per day violation with a 508 total days of violation. The prosecution team calculated a per-day adjustment factor of 0.55 based on Wicked Creations' potential for harm and deviation from requirements. The days of violation was reduced from 508 days to 50 days based on the enforcement policy's alternative approach to calculations, referred to as collapsing days. According to the enforcement policy, where a violation is not causing daily detrimental impacts to the environment or regulatory program, results in no discrete economic benefit to a discharger that can be measured on a daily basis or occurred without the knowledge of a discharger, an alternative approach to counting days of violation can be used. These factors generate an initial liability of $275,000. Next, the enforcement policy requires adjustment factors based on the discharger's conduct. The prosecution team calculated higher multipliers due to Wicked Creation's negligence, history of adjudicated violations, and uncooperativeness. By multiplying the initial liability amount by the adjustment factors, Wicked Creation's base liability amount was raised to $635,250. Next slide. Step 6 of the enforcement policy requires the calculation of Wicked Creation's economic benefit from the violation. The economic benefit was calculated using the US EPA Benefit of Noncompliance Model, or BEN model. The calculations consider the discharger's use of the money that should have been used to avoid the instance of noncompliance. Wicked Creation's lack of permit coverage allowed the discharger to avoid paying annual fees, record keeping, developing a stormwater pollution prevention plan, implementing best management practices, sampling, or developing annual reports. The total economic benefit to Wicked Creations was calculated at $20,383. Step 7 provides that if the Water Board believes that the amount determined using steps 1 through 6 is inappropriate, the amount may be adjusted so long as express findings are made to justify the adjustment. The prosecution team has made a finding that the calculated amount is disproportionate to assessments for similar conduct made in the recent past using the enforcement policy, and so have elected to reduce the penalty to $150,000. Per step 8, the prosecution team must consider Wicked Creation's ability to pay. The discharger's business profile record included a prosecution team exhibit number 40. Reported sales from the facility in 2024 to exceed $1,308,000. Based on this publicly available information, the discharger has the ability to pay the proposed penalty and remain in business. Finally, the enforcement policy directs the Santa Ana Water Board to consider the maximum and minimum liability amount. The maximum liability of $5,080,000 is set by Water Code Section 13385 per the enforcement policy. The minimum liability amount must be 10% higher than the economic benefit calculated in Step 6, which is $22,421. Application of all 10 steps of the penalty calculation methodology results in a final proposed liability amount of $150,000. Next slide. The prosecution team recommends that the board adopt the proposed order and impose the penalty of $150,000 on Wicked Creations. Thank you. Next slide. Does the board have any questions?
I'd like to thank the prosecution team for their presentation. Jessica, how much time is remaining for the prosecution team?
4 minutes and 23 seconds.
Okay, great. All right. Are there any questions from the board? Let's start with the board first. And board members have any questions? Seeing none here, do we have any questions from our remote participants?
I have none. Thank you.
And board member Rui, you need to unmute. Board member Rui, do you have any questions?
Do we have any idea why the defense did not show up today? Wicked Creations?
No, they have not been in communication with us. Okay. The last time was for the extension to this board meeting date.
Okay, so they did. They were aware of this, as we know, and they just chose not to be here.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
And then I just had some questions. So in reading the documents were provided to all of us. One of the things that stood out was different names of businesses, names of individuals, different owners, that kind of thing. And I think one of the first inspections or the earliest inspections, the person that I believe is you, David, who encountered was Ashley Newell's. And then later on in a subsequent correspondence or inspection, it was Ashley Miles. When you first visited the facility, did she clearly identify herself as Ashley Newell's, or was it maybe a misunderstanding?
It could have been a misunderstanding. Ms. Newell's wrote on when we issued the notice of noncompliance in the field, they signed something saying they received it, and that's where you can see the Newell's comes from. Later in phone calls, she went by Miss Miles, and later in the most recent inspection, she went by Ms. Poston, as well as in terms of titles, she went from initially saying she was the receptionist there to later being the manager to later being the owner of a separate business.
So she clearly signed Ashley Newell's, N-U-I-L-S.
Yes, that's in the exhibit.
Okay. So that was her writing. So she's represented herself by three different names and then also three different positions within the company. Another thing that stood out was the name of the business. I saw Wicked Creations, I saw United Metal Concepts, and then later WC Inc. or WC Enterprises. I mean, are these all different businesses? Are they the same business, or is it
So these are separate businesses operating at the same address. United Metal Concepts was also inspected, and we went through our own separate enforcement, which concluded with them going out of business. WC Manufacturing was subject to a separate enforcement action as well that ended with WC Manufacturing enrolling under the Industrial General Permit in 2025. All these businesses, they have different SIC codes, all focused on different kinds of manufacturing. All were subject to separate enforcement actions.
So for this administrative complaint, which business is actually on the hook to pay any fines if they are indeed assessed?
Wicked Creations.
So it'd definitely be Wicked Creations. And then in looking at one of the later inspections, there was a reference to a new owner. Do we know for certain that that occurred?
So in my inspection report, it went back and forth who the actual owner of WC Manufacturing was. And it was either Miss Ashley Poston or Michael Boone, who was the owner of Wicked Creations.
Okay. And as far as for the prosecution team, did they actually look into who actually owns this facility?
So we went through the Secretary of Business Licensing. We go through their business license with the City of Garden Grove, as well as asking them of who the ownerships of the property, as well as Westlaw.
And because the reason I ask is because if we were to impose this law, this fine, I mean, who I mean, who I mean, the, who would be the owner of the facility that would be have to pay this fine?
It's identified as Michael Boone
Michael Boone.
and Dominia Smith, and the principal is Dorothy Ortega.
Okay. And as far as we know, they're there, so we wouldn't be imposing any fines or penalties on a new owner that had nothing to do with these previous violations.
We issue it against Wicked Creations itself.
Okay. And then the last question I had is, what effort is involved in actually enrolling an industrial general permit, if you might? I mean, is it, do we have to hire a consultant? Do they have to hire a consultant and attorneys and prepare an extensive report, or is there some other kind of mechanism around this?
So the requirements for an industrial facility that has needs notice of intent permit coverage because there's potential for pollutants getting into stormwater, you need to develop a stormwater pollution prevention plan, which you do not need a consultant to develop, and a site map for the facility, as well as pay the permit application fee and submit a SMARTS application online.
So everything can be done online, and you would like prepare the maps and other kinds of things and just simply upload those onto the website. So the main thing you need is a user ID, and of course you create your own password. So that's the effort that's involved in it. And typically, any estimation as to how much time it often takes to create it to do this.
Based on my experience, we give the discharger 60 days to obtain permit coverage, and many of them meet that deadline with extra time, as well as we're available to answer questions if they run into issues in SMARTS, and we have help guides available for them that help them fill out the application.
So there's plenty of guidance out there.
Michelle Beckwith, I've taken the oath. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes to create a user ID in SMARTS and maybe twice that to actually submit your application.
And then a little bit more time to develop maps and other documents. And I take it that, if there is going to be an expense, it's going to be actually putting into place the best management practices that are necessary for that business. But then after that, then every year they're required to file an annual report. So, okay. Those are my questions for our advisory team. Any questions?
Just a couple, Chair. Thank you. Would you please clarify whether Wicked Creations is still in operation? Looking at your exhibits 16 and 20, there's some difference in dates that are provided. I think exhibit 16 has a closed on date of 4/25/25, and exhibit 20 references a June 2024 date. I know that you presented exhibit 30 that shows that they were still in business as of, I believe it's June 2025, and I just wondered if you could provide some more background explanation on that.
Yeah, so we have the screenshots of their website on Exhibit 30, the Facebook page of their business on Exhibit 31, my August 2025 inspection where I observed Wicked Creations facility signage, which is Exhibit 20. I can testify that the website is still active. They were having a tax back sale, which is new, and social media was updated in this last week from Wicked Creations posting. It's the same industrial activities and same ownership structure, which was confirmed during the August 2025 inspection, along with the active website and social media suggests that Wicked Creation is still in business and conducting industrial activity that requires industrial general permit coverage.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions from the advisory team?
Thank you. I just had one question regarding the final penalty calculation. I know you addressed this in your presentation, but we were wondering if we could get further clarification as to where the $150,000 amount was reached and whether other penalty amounts were considered before reaching this conclusion.
Maybe somebody will add to this, but like the presentation says, the 150,000 was determined based off step seven, which was discretionary based off of the disproportionate amount and based on similar conduct using this enforcement policy. But yeah.
Hi, my name is Carson Capps, and I'm counsel for the prosecution team. So basically, with the application of the penalty calculation methodology and the enforcement policy, it just resulted in an amount that was not really didn't reflect it was felt inappropriate for the violation, so we addressed it to or we adjusted it to an amount that is more in line with prior board orders for similar conduct, and that felt more appropriate in terms of the amount of resources that we've expended and the ongoing nature of the violation.
Thank you for your explanation.
And just for clarification, is that the same reason why the prosecution team elected not to include a staff cost separate from the amount that was reached?
I believe so, yes.
No further questions.
Okay. And then I have a follow-up question on the penalty, the proposed fine that's the plan that's being proposed. So we have a situation here where the representatives of the facility gave different names of who they were. They gave different names of the business. They talked about ownership changes and a few other things. I mean, just a lot of, I mean, in some ways, it just almost seems like deception that's involved in here. The second thing is that they were denied access at least two or three times. And is this for a penalty for this kind of behavior, is 150,000 on the high side or is that actually on the low side? I mean, we have behavior from a facility like this. Oh, and we forget to mention the fact that they haven't even paid a very small fine that we levied a couple years ago.
Yeah, the prosecution team took that all into account when we were deciding on our amount. So we feel that the proposed liability is appropriate for the violation. However, the board has discretion to raise or lower it up to the statutory maximum or the minimum that we presented in the presentation as well.
Okay. And board members have any further questions? I don't see any. Okay, so now it's time for Wicked Creations to do their presentation. And once again, I ask, is there anybody in this room that's here for Wicked Creations, or is there anybody who's online that wishes to speak for Wicked Creations? Okay. And next item, of course, asking the prosecution team to m present a rebuttal. That's not necessary, as well as Wicked Creations presenting their rebuttal. So, our next item is, are there any interested persons willing to present a comment? And if they do, they have 3 minutes each. Are there any comments? Any commenters?
No, there's no comments.
Okay. And do members of the advisory, do board members have any further questions? And this is part of the script. None. Or the advisory team have any questions?
None.
Okay. And of course, last of all, we have the prosecution team. If they could make their closing statement, and if I'm not mistaken, there's 4 minutes and 23 seconds left.
Great. Thank you, Chair Scandura and board members. My name again is Carson Capps, and I'm the counsel for the prosecution team. In closing, this matter is an example of the Santa Ana Water Board's enforcement program working as intended and following the tenets of progressive enforcement. Progressive enforcement contemplates an escalating series of actions, beginning with notifications of violations and compliance assistance, followed by enforcement orders compelling compliance, culminating in a complaint for civil liabilities like we brought before you today. Staff has walked you through all of these efforts to date, and we are now at a point where assessing this large penalty is appropriate and necessary to achieve the desired deterrent effect on the dischargers and the regulated community as a whole. The prosecution team has satisfied our burden of proof in demonstrating that regulatory coverage is required pursuant to Water Code 13376. We've presented evidence that the discharger is a person who is discharging pollutants into a water of the United States without obtaining proper regulatory coverage. And as we've said, this facility remains unregulated to this day. And for their part, the dischargers have not submitted anything to refute our legal arguments or our assertions of fact. And just to address, there were some questions about whether or not they had proper notice of today's hearing. The complaint, along with proof of service to the discharger, is included as Prosecution Team Exhibit 41. In calculating our proposed liability, the prosecution team has considered all the relevant statutory factors through the application of the enforcement policy, as David walked you through. The proposed liability is supported by the facts and is reasonable in light of all the circumstances that we've discussed. And then just a note as well, if the liability remains unpaid after the notices are received, then the board has many options of how to further pursue the payment of these liabilities. But the most common method that we see is placing a lien on the discharger's property, their real property, or if they have a sufficiently valuable like machine or something in their facility, then they could put a lien on that as well. So in closing, the prosecution team recommends that the board adopt our proposed order as drafted. And thank you very much for your time. And we remain available for further questions.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And of course, this is the opportunity for Wicked Creations to make a closing statement. Nobody is here from Wicked Creations. So I would like to now close this public hearing. And then I'd like to, and then at this point, the board can either discuss the matter openly in this forum, or we can go to closed session if there is. I'd like to ask the board what their pleasure is, if they'd like to go into a closed session or discuss openly. Board Member Clark.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think we should elect to go into closed session to discuss and then resume.
I'm seeing nods from other board members also on remotely.
I'm comfortable either way. But I'm happy to accommodate my colleague's request to talk in closed session.
I'm comfortable with it as it is. So,
yeah, I'm supportive of
session. Yeah. I just need to have the link sent to me.
Okay. I'd like to have a brief closed session. I have a couple questions or things I'd like to discuss with board members. So with that, we can go ahead and move to closed session.
The board will now meet in closed session to discuss item number 10 for a deliberation on a decision to be reached based on the evidence introduced in a hearing pursuant to Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision C3. The board will reconvene when they have completed their deliberations.
And then how do those who are remotely?
Definitely. So
okay.
Just make sure that they get sent again.
Okay. Okay. All right. We have returned from closed session, and we are resuming our open session here. So the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board met regarding the allegations as well as the proposed fine or the proposed penalty. And our decision is that we do find Wicked Creations to be liable for a violation of the state water code for failing to enroll under the industrial general permit program. We had quite a bit of discussion about the adequacy of the penalty that was being proposed. We have decided to go with a penalty of $150,000 plus the staff costs of $4,603. And then the last item is that there are some things that we want to make sure go into the order itself. And so we're going to be directing our staff counsel or on the advisory team to make those changes. And counsel, anything else to add to that?
No, we will. Update the order to the evidence received and to the board's direction, and then present that at the future board meeting.
Okay. And then at this point, are there any comments by the board members on this? And online?
None for me.
Okay. And all I can say is I think, first of all, I want to thank the prosecution team for putting together all the evidence that they presented for us, and also for all of their testimony. Obviously a very difficult case. I think what I've had so many issues here is that on the part of the facility is basically deliberately ignoring the state water code, the water code, and particularly the requirement to file under the industrial general permit program. I mean, there's reasons we have this program, and that is to, first of all, make facilities aware of the discharges that they have into the waters of the state, and then to take actions to prevent those discharges from occurring, and then reporting periodically, at least on an annual basis, what they're doing to prevent discharges into waters of the state, in this case, the East Garden Grove Wintersburg Channel. This business has been around since at least 2013, 2014. They failed back when they first opened up to enroll in this program, and they've continued to. We actually levied a fine for $7,376 against this business a couple years ago. They basically ignored that. In going through the record, it just seems like there's so much deception and obfuscation on their part in terms of representing who they are, who the employees are, and what they do, who the owners are, even the name of the business. It's very, very difficult. And then on top of that, they've denied access to the facility all but one time. And so I think this is more than appropriate, and we'll be taking this up at a future meeting. So with that, I'd like to move on to the regular session then. Okay, so we're done with item 10, and item 11 is the executive officer's report. I'm not even giving our executive officer a chance to breathe. That's just, we're cracking the whip on him.
That's what I'm here for.
Okay, so if our executive officer would like to give his report.
Thank you, Chair Scandura. Just a couple of brief things that I'd like to update the board on. The copper TMDL, one of the priorities that we've expressed for the calendar year 2026 is to see that TMDL through the Office of Administrative Law and eventually to US EPA review for the final steps of adoption. And I'm happy to say that OAL now has the copper TMDL as passed by the state board. So that box is checked. We expect that review to take some time. And then US EPA has been made aware that this is coming. We met with staff. And my understanding is that they may seek more than a 30-day review period for that. So it's moving along, though we don't have a definitive deadline. In response to board member requests, staff have posted the 2025 calendar year accomplishments on the website. We took what was, you know, three expansive presentations and boiled it down to a three-page something of an infographic so that it's easily digestible and I think tailored to the audience that will take a look at that. So if you haven't already, please go to our website. It's right up front. I'd like to give the board members a heads up that in the coming months, perhaps in the next two or three meetings, there will be a non-regulatory basin plan amendment brought to the board. I mention it because this is a bit of an unusual basin plan amendment. It's editorial in nature. We're updating certain sections, particularly chapters 1 through 4, which haven't been touched in quite some time. So it's not a non-regulatory basin plan amendment is not intended to change objectives or present new data and analysis. It's meant to primarily focus on editorial changes. That being said, I think that the board members will be pleased to see that we've been fairly extensive in our updates. Let's see. There were two questions earlier that I'd like to just go ahead and perhaps steal board member Diadamo's thunder for the next update. There was a question asked about the WOTUS rule, that is to say the waters of the US. The update that I can provide is that the comment period for the US EPA and US Army Corps' proposed Waters of the US revisions closed on January 5th. As of right now, the agencies are reviewing those public comments, drafting responses, conducting analyses, and waiting on internal and intra-agency clearances. So we wait with bated breath to see what the final version of that proposed rulemaking will be. As of now, there's no other news to share. On the other question that was brought up is about the current snowpack status. And I do have some basic statistics to share with the group. The statewide snow water equivalent is about 50% of normal to date. That's not good news. Even worse, the statewide snow water enforcement, or excuse me, snow water equivalent, been a lot of enforcement going on lately. Peaked towards the end of February at around 61% of the April 1st average, which was good news at the time. That was over 16 inches. But it has since melted down to 50% of that benchmark, which is a little bit more than 13 inches, meaning that 20% of the peak snowpack melted in February and March. And that is not good news for our water supplies. And incidentally, the Northern Sierra portion of our snowpack reservoir is much lower than the southern portion, which is bad news for Oroville and the State Water Project. So with the opportunities for winter storms dwindling, all we can do is cross our fingers that something will change, but it doesn't look very good for water deliveries in the coming dry months. And with that, that's the EO report that I have to offer for this meeting. Happy to take questions or direction from the board members.
Any questions? Board Member Lopez.
Yeah, I was just going to get the region, San Diego region, the MS4 permit. Could we get a recap? Not, but maybe at some point in maybe the next board meeting. Oh, I'm sorry. Get a recap of the MS4 permit.
So the current status of the regional MS4 permit is that we hope to release the revised regional MS4 permit in April or perhaps May for public comment. That will have the response to comments from the previous round. And I hope to schedule a hearing in front of this board in the summer months. So we are getting closer. But right now, my best estimate as staff and legal work together to get this out into the public sphere is late April or early May.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any. Well, thank you very much, Eric. And this now brings us to our last item, which is board member communications. And I'll start with here in the room, Board Member Lopez. None.
I'll just note that I served on a panel about commissioner or appointed positions by the governor a couple months ago, hosted by my local supervisors, Vince Sarmiento and Katrina Foley. And they were just encouraging people to apply to be appointed. So I talked about my experience on this board. Of course, all good accolades, encouraging folks to apply and serve the great state of California. So wanted to thank Supervisor Sarmiento for that opportunity, as well as the governor's appointments office, and just remind people that there's an opportunity to apply it at no cost, and all different levels of experience and expertise are welcome. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Earlier, it was highlighted that California is doing really good during our liaisons report, and that we are at the front of preventing using groundwater recharge and reducing wildfires. And it was highlighted that this region is doing really good. So I just want to commend the staff and everyone who is involved in keeping us up to date and actually doing such a good job. Definitely proud to serve and be part of this team. And I will encourage our communities also, which is one of the biggest things that was mentioned today, how difficult it is to do outreach in our communities. And I want to encourage our communities to ask questions, get involved, and be part of also this great efforts to not only provide quality water, but to make sure that we remember that water is life, and it is everybody's responsibility. With that, thank you so much for having us, and thank you to all for your service.
For our remote participants, Board Member Rue.
I don't have anything today. Thank you.
Okay. And Board Member Murray.
I have no comments today either. Just wish you all well and thank the staff again for the work that was done on the public hearings. One I know was postponed, but the second one where we made a decision. So thank you. Everybody was involved in both.
Okay. And then as for me, just a quick report on the board. Every month, the water board chairs all meet remote or in a video conference to talk about what's going on in their regions, as well as what's going on at the state level. And so we heard a couple really good reports about the problems down in the San Diego region with the Tijuana River, 41 million gallons a day of sewage that's dumped in there, and what's being done to try to address that. There's also the new river problems in the Palm Desert region, where quite a bit of pollution is in there. The big thing that's coming up, and you may have received your invitation already, the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting is going to be on May 14th and 15th, so about 2 months from now in Sacramento. They're already starting to plan the agenda. One of the things we hope is that the governor's office will be there to talk about the status of new appointments. This is a tricky year because this is the last year of the current governor's administration. So how active they're going to be in making appointments, especially new appointments. That's one of the things we're going to definitely want to hear from them. And then also some discussions on some other things, including the amount of water that's being used by all these data centers. We hear all about the energy that data centers use, but they also use quite a bit of water. So hope the agenda for that should come out in the next month or so. And then last of all, I just wanted to ask our board members, For these meetings, in order to be able to conduct the meetings, we have to have four members that are physically present. And that's been a problem the last few meetings, in that when board members are late or get stuck in traffic or they can't come at all, it jeopardizes our ability to conduct the meeting. So I do ask all the board members that if they are going to participate remotely, please, do so, out of clear necessity, and to so that we can make sure that we have our meetings, especially because we are going to be taking up enforcement cases like the Wicked Creations case in the next two meetings, and then probably sometime this summer, July or September, we're going to be taking up the MS4 permit. So it's going to be very important that all of us be present to the maximum extent possible. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and adjourn this meeting to April 24th at the Irvine Ranch Water District in Irvine.